to this.
Hop on board for a serendipitous musical journey as we create a playlist of 5 tracks.
The new series of Add to Playlist.
On Friday nights at 7:15.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 20th of November. This is Today with Nick Robinson and Emma Barnett.
Good morning. The headlines today. US officials are in Ukraine for talks to end the war, amid reports that it'll be asked to make major territorial concessions under a Russian and American peace proposal. Donald Trump has completed a U-turn by approving a measure to release files on the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood has said her border security plans are needed to stop what she calls illegitimate forces taking hold of the debate on immigration.
If mainstream politics cannot have a discussion about secure borders and the rules by which people enter this country and the rules by which they must leave, if we cede that territory to the far right, then we have let our country down.
Also coming up in today's programme, as an exhibition celebrates Wes Anderson's distinctive style, the director of those beautiful films, Grand Budapest Hotel and Fantastic Mr. Fox, amongst many, tells us it's all an accident.
I think the next film I make, it may be less immediately recognisable as mine, but I always think that.
And as Australian teens get ready for the ban on them using social media.
I think it's pointless. There's so many better things that they could do to keep children safe. I think no matter what, how hard they try, people are always going to find a way around it.
Indeed, especially young people, they will find it if there is a way. We'll get more into that story a bit later on. But first, the BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
American military officials will hold talks in Ukraine on efforts to end the war, amid reports that Washington and Moscow have held discussions without Kiev and are proposing that it should make major concessions. According to unconfirmed reports on the Axios news website, the proposals would mean Ukraine ceding territory, and it would also place limits on the country's military and long-range weapons in return for US security guarantees. From Washington, here's our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman.
President Trump's plan, not only for a truce but a full end to the war, has barely budged since his Alaska summit with Vladimir Putin in August. This latest reported attempt to revive a framework for negotiations followed discussions between Mr. Trump's aide, Steve Witkoff, and Mr. Putin's envoy, Kirill Dmitriev, according to unnamed officials quoted by the news website Axios. The proposal would reportedly require Ukraine to make sweeping concessions, including surrendering the Donbass region and limiting the size of its military. Moscow has made these demands before, and they are seen by Kyiv as capitulation. The US State Department would not comment on the reports, and the Secretary of State Marco Rubio has not directly addressed them, but in a social media post wrote of the need for an exchange of realistic ideas and concessions from both sides. Washington has recently toughened its stance on Moscow with new sanctions and could be preparing to press President Zelensky harder over what he and his European allies have always regarded as red lines.
Donald Trump says he has signed into law the bill to release the files on the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, one of the biggest U-turns of his second presidency. Mr. Trump had long resisted calls to make the information public, but faced pressure from his own supporters. The president, who was once friends with Jeffrey Epstein, insists he knew nothing about the paedophile financier's crimes. Our North America correspondent David Willis reports.
President Trump had doggedly resisted the release of files relating to the criminal activities of his former friend until as recently as last weekend. On Sunday, however, facing the biggest rebellion of his presidency in Congress, he capitulated, prompting a near unanimous vote to publish the documents. But the big question is how many of the files will actually be released. The bill allows for the withholding of material that could compromise an ongoing investigation. And just last Friday, President Trump ordered an inquiry into Epstein's links to several of his Democratic opponents.
The public inquiry into the COVID pandemic will this afternoon publish its findings into the government's response. It will offer its assessment of the unprecedented use of lockdowns to control the spread of the disease from March 2020. More than 160 people have given evidence, including the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
In a report of around 800 pages, the inquiry's chair, Baroness Hallett, will examine the decisions made by the UK government and devolved administrations. It'll look at whether lockdowns were timely and reasonable, whether ministers considered how they would affect people, and whether there was effective communication with the public. Baroness Hallett is also due to cover public confidence in the measures imposed and breaches of the rules and standards, including by ministers and officials. She'll set out recommendations for policymakers.
The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has warned that mainstream politicians must discuss border security and immigration, or they'll let the country down by allowing extremists to dominate the debate. In an interview with Nick Robinson on Political Thinking, she also defended a pilot scheme offering higher payments to failed asylum seekers if they leave the country voluntarily. Here's our political correspondent, Leila Nathu.
Shabana Mahmood mounted a strong defence of the raft of changes she's made to the asylum system. The package is modelled on a tougher approach taken by Denmark and includes making refugee status temporary and ending housing and financial support. Denmark also offers higher payments than the £3,000 available in the UK to failed asylum seekers to return to their home countries voluntarily. Ms Mahmood said she was willing to consider a big increase to the current payment, saying each asylum seeker in the country cost the taxpayer £30,000 per year, and that a cash incentive to return was often better value for money.
You can hear the full interview now on Political Thinking on BBC Sounds. One of the world's leading artificial intelligence firms, Nvidia, has reported better than expected quarterly revenue of $57 billion, reflecting strong demand for its sophisticated chips. The California-based company also recorded a profit of more than $31 billion. NHS doctors say they plan to use AI to spot growth that could lead to bowel cancer. The National Institute for Health and Care Excellence has said five technologies should be made available while more evidence is gathered on whether they save lives. The disease is the UK's fourth most common cancer. Here's our health and science correspondent, James Gallagher.
During a colonoscopy, a tiny camera is guided through the bowel so doctors can hunt for small growths called polyps. These can become cancerous, so are normally removed during the procedure. Artificial intelligence software has been trained on thousands of images of polyps, so now it can also watch the video feed and act like a second pair of eyes looking for unusual growths. The National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, known as NICE, said there was clear evidence that AI helped to discover more polyps.
The technology firm Meta, which owns Instagram, Facebook and Threads, says it's shutting down the accounts of Australians who are under 16. A ban on this group using social media, which is due to come into force later next month, has been criticised by the companies. The firms could be fined up to £25 million if they don't comply.
Thank you, Jane. 7 minutes past six. Chilly. Let's go over to the BBC Weather Centre. Sarah Keith-Lucas can give us a rather more rounded account of the weather. Morning, Sarah.
Yes, morning to you, Nick. Cold air across the UK at the moment. Temperatures sitting at around -4, -5 degrees for many of us. So a sharp frost, certainly some icy stretches and plenty of warnings to talk about today as well for snow and ice. Now, let's start with England and Wales. And it's around exposed eastern and western coasts we've got those warnings. So in the east, anywhere from Northumberland down towards Suffolk, and in the west, parts of Devon, Cornwall, Pembrokeshire, southwest Wales generally. We also have a higher level amber warning for the North York Moors. So at lower levels, 2 to 5 centimetres of snow expected today around these exposed coastal areas. Over the hills, particularly the North York Moors, 15 to 25 centimetres of snow. Now, the snow showers are going to be on and off through the day, but they will ease as we head through the latter part of the afternoon. Away from these exposed eastern and western coasts, for the rest of England and Wales, a lot of dry weather, blue sky, sunshine and less windy than it was yesterday. For Scotland and Northern Ireland, some yellow warnings here for snow and ice too, across Northern Ireland and for northern and eastern parts of Scotland. So again, at low levels, 2 to 5 centimetres of snow, could be more than 10 centimetres though over the higher ground. Central and southwest Scotland stay largely dry again with a blue sky and the sunshine. Temperatures today will range between about 2 to 4 degrees across northern parts of the UK, 4 to 6 towards the south. So not feeling particularly warm, but at least we've lost the breeze that we had yesterday. Overnight, sleet and snow eases away, so mostly dry, clear and cold again. Do watch out for icy stretches. Could be some travel delays. Tomorrow does look like a brighter, drier day for most of us. Still a few showers lingering in the southeast.
Sarah, thank you. We've got the vests on, or I do certainly. Now, let's have a look at the morning papers and the headlines at 9 minutes past six. Officials familiar with the US plan, apparently to end the war in Ukraine, tell the Daily Telegraph that it would see Kyiv receive a rental fee in exchange for Russia taking control of the Donbas region. The report says Russia would also be made an official, would be made an official language, and Ukraine's military would be halved. But one insider tells the paper that US officials are being strung along by Moscow. The Financial Times quotes a source as saying the deal is very comfortable for President Putin, while an official in Kyiv said it would be a non-starter for Ukraine.
What's described as a North Sea standoff is the lead in the Daily Mirror after a Russian spy ship on the edge of UK waters was accused of targeting RAF pilots with lasers. The Guardian describes the move as part of a pattern of Russian incursions into NATO-controlled territory. According to the Sun, tensions are escalating amid mounting fury at Moscow. The paper's headline, and I'm going to read this slowly and carefully, is "Ship Hits the Fan."
You did that very well, indeed.
Yeah, I practised.
There we go. Trans guide to protect women is left in limbo. That's what the front page of The Times says. It says it has seen the new guidance, which suggests that places such as hospitals and gyms should be able to ban transgender people from single-sex spaces based on how they look or behave. The paper accuses ministers of sitting on the plan from the Equality and Human Rights Commission, reporting that some in Whitehall are concerned that Labour is delaying publication. But a government source dismisses that as total nonsense.
The Eye paper reports that ministers are planning to allow local authorities in London and South East England to raise council tax above the 5% cap without a public vote to help them cover losses from what it calls a funding shake-up. The paper says an overhaul will see grants diverted to areas with higher spending needs, mainly in the Midlands and the north of England.
And ahead of the budget, next week, the Daily Express calls on the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, to keep the pension triple lock. The report highlights figures which suggest millions more pensioners could be plunged into poverty if the measure is scrapped. The Daily Mail, meanwhile, leads with a different set of statistics which it says deliver an excoriating verdict on Ms Reeves. The paper says a shock YouGov poll has found that 0% of those surveyed believe the economy is in a very good state.
It's coming up now to 12 minutes past six.
Now, senior US military officials are in Ukraine for talks on ending the war and are expected to meet President Zelensky as President Trump tries once again to end the war. This is against the backdrop of unconfirmed reports. We were talking about some of them just a moment ago, that US and Russian officials have created a new peace plan with major concessions that have long been said to be red lines for Ukraine. James Waterhouse is our Ukraine correspondent. James, first of all, these are senior Pentagon officials. Tell us what we know.
Well, Emma, President Zelensky is on his way back from Turkey after meeting President Erdogan, and waiting for him will be Dan Driscoll, the US Army Secretary, flanked by two four-star generals. And it seems, as you say, that they will present him with a plan with no fewer than 28 points. And if you go along the flurry of reports we've seen over the past 12 hours or so, it amounts to Ukraine having to agree to a smaller military, halving it, according to some sources being quoted. It involves Ukraine reducing the amount of weaponry it would hold. And it would also, and I think it's the thickest of red lines for Kyiv to this point, see Ukraine give up the remaining eastern Donbass region, which amounts to major cities that have not come close to falling, although they've fallen, you know, they've certainly come closer to the Russian advance. And so, you know, we've talked at length about Donald Trump's state visits, European leaders going with Mr. Zelensky to the White House. And this flurry of diplomatic activity still has not been sufficient, it seems, to prevent the US and Russia engaging with each other directly before imposing their brokered deal on Ukraine caught in the middle?
There's a lot of ifs here, and they are unconfirmed reports at this point, but they are widely carried with these sorts of details. With your knowledge of Ukraine and the temperature in the country at the moment, and you know how the politicians are and where the war is actually up to, are any of those red lines negotiable, do you think? Is there any starter in this, if it is to be believed, these particular lines?
I think they, by not very much, Emma, are more negotiable because President Zelensky's domestic position has weakened. We are seeing opposition MPs break rank because of a corruption scandal where allegations are being aimed firmly at his closest aides and confidants. And now there are widespread denials around a case seeing, you know, senior Ukrainian officials once again allegedly skim tens of millions of dollars off government infrastructure projects to line their own pockets, and implicated are figures close to Zelensky, who Zelensky is friends with. The president is not thought to be implicated, but it seems that Donald Trump might have looked at this as some kind of political opportunity. But we have to remind ourselves, we're talking about security guarantees that Ukraine is desperate for to prevent Russia from, as it has done for the last decade or so, prevent Russia from, yes, agreeing, playing lip service to a ceasefire before reigniting its invasion once more. And at the moment, these proposals see Ukraine's military diminishing. And I guess the question would be, what would the US provide in return? It would have to be meaty, but you could flip it and say, this could be a way out for Ukraine. It allows Ukraine to make this war a story of survival. It allows Ukraine to, albeit with reduced territory and having to cave to Russian demands that have not moved, it allows Ukraine to continue existing as a sovereign country and perhaps hold elections, maybe. But I think at the moment, once again in these talks, it's not starting. It's having a standing start and not from a position of strength.
We'll get more into this with the former ambassador to Ukraine for America coming up a bit later in the programme, and stick with this story as it develops. James Waterhouse, our Ukraine correspondent, thank you.
16 minutes past six. It's 30 years since that interview, the interview which shocked the world, the interview in which Princess Diana declared there were three of us in this marriage. A new book just out examines the controversies surrounding how Martin Bashir landed that interview for BBC's Panorama programme. Helena Wilkinson has been taking a look. Do we learn anything new, Helena?
Well, I think what's interesting, Nick, about this book, as you say, it's a re-examination of that infamous interview with Diana, Princess of Wales, how that came about. Andy Webb, the journalist and author, re-examines. He talks about what he says is the true extent of Martin Bashir's deception, trying to get that interview. And also he goes through, I think the second part of the book is about what he says are the layers of BBC cover-up that followed. What's interesting is a press release that was given with the book for us to read says it was written with the full support from Charles Spencer, Diana's brother. And in the book, Andy Webb recalls Earl Spencer's role changing from a source to a partner in the story. It talks about how Earl Spencer took many, many notes, and he passed these on to Andy Webb, who has outlined them in his book. An interesting part is that we learn from the book that Earl Spencer didn't at first criticise Martin Bashir over the interview. He said he didn't want to say anything that would question his sister, Princess Diana's, decision to speak to him. But then it was when Andy Webb was making a Channel 4 documentary about the interview after that, that Earl Spencer finally went public with his concerns. Andy Webb talks about how Earl Spencer rang him during a 40-minute conversation because Andy Webb had told Earl Spencer about a document that had been provided under the Freedom of Information by the BBC, which suggested that Earl Spencer had shown Martin Bashir bank statements, when in fact it was Martin Bashir who had done so. So it was after that, we learned from the book, that Earl Spencer spoke out about what happened on the morning of transmission of this Channel 4 documentary, outlining for the first time how he had been shown those statements, and also a number of other outlandish allegations by Bashir. in the book, Andy Webb says that Earl Spencer made a decision, Andy Webb made a decision based on little more than a gut feeling that the BBC had been lying and Earl Spencer had been telling the truth.
Helena Wilkinson, thank you.
It's 19 minutes past six. The microchip giant NVIDIA, behind so much of that AI technology, has beaten sales expectations. Sean Farrington has more on that and an interview with the boss of Ford about the impact of taxes on electric vehicles. Morning, Sean.
Yeah, morning, Emma. Lots more to come from Lisa Brankin at Ford on those Chinese EVs, future of car manufacturing in the UK. Concerns about that new pay-per-mile tax could be on its way at the budget. But first, the world's most valuable company that makes so many of those computer chips required for the AI boom at data centres dotted around the place, NVIDIA. The world looked to its results to see if there are any signs of a bubble bursting. NVIDIA seems to have replied with a resounding, not here, there aren't any signs. The chief executive, Jensen Huang, talking of sales being off the charts, some products being sold out. Simon French is chief economist at Panmure Liberum. Simon, morning to you.
Good morning.
What are
Sean.
The numbers telling us?
Impressive revenue data from NVIDIA, up 62% year on year to $57 billion in the third quarter, matched by net income, so up to $32 billion. The comments, as you rightly say, from the chief exec suggested demand, if anything, is accelerating, and that's why it's a $4.5 trillion company, albeit the share price, it did rally after hours 5%, has been a bit softer in recent days, but more of a reflection of concern over the sort of the structure and the sustainability of the whole AI sector rather than necessarily NVIDIA's results.
What will that mean now? I'm just seeing this morning that the stock markets in Japan are up, you know, not far off 3%. Is that going to be the mood for the next few days?
Well, it's a function really of market concentration in US tech. The US stock market makes up three quarters of the global stock market, and therefore sentiment and results there have a spillover effect on what you're picking up in terms of Japanese results. And I suspect when London opens is that positive mood getting its cue from the US technology sector.
And talks of a bubble, are they gone now or do they move to other parts?
The issue with the bubble is on valuation grounds across the whole US stock market, which is at a cyclically adjusted price earnings level, which is a well-watched measure of how expensive the market is, at 40 times, which has parallels with the dot-com bubble about 25 years ago. The issue is not so much these big cash generative companies like NVIDIA, but it's the wider part of the tech ecosystem, quite a lot of which isn't currently profitable.
Simon, thank you. Simon French from Panmure Liberum. The boss of Ford in the UK says the market for electric vehicles is distorted. She's having to push people into buying them. It isn't the time to tax EVs. I've been speaking to Chair and Managing Director Lisa Brankin in the latest episode of Big Boss Interview on BBC Sounds. A company directly employing more than 5,000 people here in the UK. Doesn't manufacture the finished car or van anymore here, but it still makes engines in Dagenham, EV components in Halewood. We talked about the future of Dagenham. She gave an intriguing answer when I asked about the possibility of a deal with a Chinese EV manufacturer. We started by discussing about the current demand for electric vehicles.
The UK government has probably got one of the most ambitious climate change objectives in the world. It's going to be carbon neutral by 2050. A big bit of getting to that target was electrifying transport, because transport is kind of one of the big emitters. And the government introduced a bit of legislation called the Vehicle Emissions Trading Scheme. And what that means is each year, manufacturers have got to sell a bigger and bigger mix of electric vehicles. Now, when that was decided and set a number of years ago, the outlook for demand around electric vehicles was really buoyant, and there seemed to be momentum behind electric vehicles. What we're seeing now is that customer demand is not in line with that ambition. So by 2030, we need to sell 80% of our vehicles, passenger cars, as electric, and 70% of vans as electric. And if we don't hit the year-by-year targets, we have really punitive fines. It's really easy to sell people things they want. It's hard to sell people things they don't want. So electric vehicles, in some instances, have gone from being a great thing to being something that we're trying to push people into. And that comes in terms of heavy discounting. And it's resulting in lower residual values. The used car market has got lower prices for those vehicles because it doesn't have the demand for it. So we're seeing sort of a market that EV market as a marketplace under quite a lot of pressure, as opposed to sort of saying that it's a normalising, because we, as manufacturers, we're pressurising the market. It hasn't quite got to be a normal market. It's a very much a distorted market.
So people don't want electric cars as much as they did?
They do want electric cars, but maybe not at the level and ambition that the government has target us with. The car market isn't just one big homogenous market. There's different sectors of it. There's a bit of it that's retail customers, that's individuals. It's a bit of it that's businesses or whose employees buy vehicles. Some of it is motability and the rest is rental or demonstrators. That company car bit of the market, there's a really beneficial tax benefit. If you drive an electric vehicle, your company car tax is much lower than driving a petrol or diesel. And that bit of the market is about 40% electric, because end customers want to have that benefit and they want to drive electric vehicles. The retail bit of the market, that end user bit of the market, is around about 15 or 16%. And our target for VETS compliance is 28% on cars this year. So we're seeing very much a variability of demand. Yes, there is demand, but it's just not quite at the level that the government has set an ambition for us to reach.
But why has that desire for those cars gone? Given at first there might have been a novelty, so you get that wave of people wanting a new bit of tech and interested in that, but people have been able to try and test these things now, and it sounds like they're thinking, actually, maybe not for me.
So I'm not sure that, you know, everybody has tried and tested and rejected, I think would be my first point. I think people have a lot of concerns over electric, and they don't have to buy, because you can still buy petrol or diesel. So I think a lot of people are not taking the chance, and they're sticking with what they know and what they feel really comfortable with, because it is actually quite a big change. I mean, driving the car, getting in and driving it, is the same as driving a petrol or diesel, but the whole way of transport, the idea that you charge overnight, that you plan your journeys, that's something that you've never had to do before. And I think a lot of people are concerned or anxious about that.
How much is the influx of Chinese cars on the market in the UK having an impact on the way customers are viewing their buying decisions at the moment, whether choosing Chinese cars right now because many see them as cheaper, or just thinking there might be cheaper ones on the way, so I'll hold fire?
Certainly, there's many, many more competitors in the market than there ever has been, and there's certainly been, you know, much more choice for consumers, and we're seeing, you know, consumers exercising that choice. Beyond that, I'm not sure I can give you, you know, a really good answer to that question, I don't think.
How does that change things for Ford, you know, one of the most established car brands globally, now maybe having the biggest competition battle on its hands it's ever had? How do you approach that as a wider business? What do those in America say to you when they see that you're coming up against these Chinese car companies?
Well, our CEO, Jim Farley, certainly been very public and saying that, you know, the battle with the Chinese is a global battle, and one that he's kind of set out to win. Competition's good for customers, right? You know, we can't say that it's not, and it keeps everybody on their toes, but it's very tough. And our job is to try to make sure that we're relevant to customers, that we maintain relevance and we offer value. We were really pleased that we got the highest level of electric car grant, and that's based off of obviously price, but also around environmental credentials around the manufacturing process. And we're the first manufacturer to get that level of grant. So that kind of endorses our investment and our manufacturing in Europe. You can become obsessed with watching what your competition is doing, which is always important. But I think you've also got to focus on what you need to do to make sure that you deliver for your customers that you know well.
Do you think customers are less brand loyal? Do you notice that than they were in the past?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. I think that's very fair to say that people are less brand loyal. I think also, you know, if you look at France or Germany, where they have more, a stronger home manufacturer, there's probably a little bit more brand loyalty in those markets. But certainly in the UK, where we don't really, I mean, obviously, you know, we have manufactured here, we have a strong representation here, as does other manufacturers, but we don't have kind of that really big home manufacturer. I think there's less brand loyalty in the UK.
Of course, well, once upon a time, when Dagenham in his heyday, etc., you know, people would have felt like the Ford they were buying was a British car. Mm. Has that actually made it harder for Ford with its sales in the UK by making its manufacturing base smaller?
I don't think it's made it harder. I mean, we still have a really big footprint in the UK. So we've got our research and development centre in Essex, which is primarily involved in developing commercial vehicles, is kind of a really big footprint for us in Europe, is based here. We manufacture engines in Dagenham still, and we manufacture transmissions, and the power units that drive some of our European electric vehicles are built in Halewood, which we're really pleased about. So we still have a really big footprint in the UK, we're just not producing vehicles.
And Dagenham's future, given how much we're talking about electric vehicles and it's diesel engines that are being built there, is it inevitable that Dagenham will not have a manufacturing base there, or do you have plans to transform that into something that's part of your electric supply chain?
Dagenham will build diesel engines right up to 2030 and maybe a little bit beyond. It's not just for Europe. They don't just build for the European market.
It's not long away now, though, is it?
No,
2030?
It's not. And that's one of the things that we're working really hard on, and what the next life of Dagenham looks like.
What could that be when you say working really hard on it, if it's not diesel engines?
There's lots of different opportunities for Dagenham, nothing that we've settled on at the moment, and still kind of exploring different opportunities in conjunction with the workforce there.
We have seen some other major car manufacturers do tie-ups with Chinese car companies. Is that something on the horizon for Ford?
That's a really good question, Sean, and not what I'm going to answer today.
Oh, interesting. So we may well...
I didn't say no.
We will stay tuned for that then. Lisa Brankin, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You can hear plenty more from the boss of Ford in the UK on BBC Sounds Now. Search for Big Boss Interview on BBC Sounds. You'll hear a bit more after seven as well. I'll be back then.
John, look forward to that. Thank you. Just after 6:30 now, and here's Mike with the sport. Morning, Mike.
Morning, Nick. Let's start with football, shall we? Because Arsenal are seemingly back on track in the Women's Champions League.
Corner swung in, Robertson plays down, and the header is in! And Arsenal have doubled their advantage! They've come from behind to lead Real Madrid by 2-1, and it's Alessia Russo in there once again, and Arsenal have turned this game around!
Yes, Alessia Russo scored twice as Arsenal claimed a 2-1 win over Real Madrid in the Women's Champions League last night. The England international headed in both goals in the second half to hand René Slager's side a much-needed win.
It's hard because you want to say so many things about Alessia, because there's so many things to her, not only as a football player but also as a person. She takes care of the team in such a good way. She role models all the right behaviours. She sees people, she includes people, she works hard, she's 100% every day, always wants to learn things.
Yes, so after three games without a win, Arsenal are now on course to qualify for the knockout stages. Manchester United's 100% record in the Women's Champions League this season, though, was ended yesterday by two-time winners Wolfsburg. They came from behind to win 5-2. Tonight, Chelsea face a tough test against Barcelona, a team that they've lost to in each of the last three Champions League semi-finals. You can hear that game on 5 Live tonight from 8 p.m. You can also watch it on the iPlayer. Next to cricket, and we are now less than one day to go until the start of the Ashes, about just under 20 hours, to go, not that we're counting down. Both captains have been speaking to the media overnight, so let's hear from both of them briefly, starting with the Australian stand-in skipper Steve Smith. How's he feeling on the eve of the series opener in Perth?
Yeah, I'm pretty chilled. Yeah, I think I've learned a lot over my journey, and yeah, the couple of times that I've stood in for Paddy, you know, I've tried to be pretty relaxed and let the game play, and yeah, obviously I've got to do it my own way out there and have my own style, but yeah, I'm a lot more relaxed these days, chilled, and you know, let the guys go about their work.
Smith is standing in for regular Australian captain Pat Cummings, who's injured. Fast bowler Josh Hazlewood is also missing for the home side. But England captain Ben Stokes says those big name omissions for Australia doesn't change his side's approach to the first test.
We won't be taking this game any easier or any more lightly than we would if Pat and Josh were playing, because we know, you know, Australia, incredibly competitive team, very passionate about sport, very passionate about cricket. And the two guys who, you know, step in to replace Pat and Josh in this game, we know that we're going to be in for a tough challenge just as much as we find ourselves up against when we play Pat and Josh.
And we'll hear more from Smith and Stokes in the next hour of the programme. And finally, England's netballers suffered a 55-49 defeat yesterday in the deciding game of their three-match series with New Zealand in Manchester.
Mike, thank you. We'll see you again shortly. Let's hear now about a history series, a fascinating one, we are promised, starting next week.
I'm David Cannadine, and in a new series for Radio 4, I'm exploring the objects and emblems that embody the British Constitution.
There is no greater symbol of national unity than our Union Jack.
In each episode, I'll be uncovering the stories behind these different materials of state and asking how they speak to the past, present and future of British political history.
There are always going to be sources of discussion, debate and disagreement.
Materials of State begins on Monday afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Time now, 26 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Nick Robinson. And Jane Steele has got a summary of the news for us.
Senior Pentagon officials will meet President Zelensky in Ukraine today for discussions on President Trump's efforts to end the war. Unconfirmed media reports say that US and Russian envoys have come up with a set of proposals for restarting negotiations between Kiev and Moscow. They would reportedly require Ukraine to make sweeping concessions, including completely withdrawing from the eastern Donbass region and limiting the size of its military. Donald Trump has signed into law a bill ordering the release of files related to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The US Justice Department now has 30 days to publish the documents. Mr. Trump previously opposed releasing the documents but changed course after facing pressure from some of his own supporters and members of his own Republican Party. The COVID inquiry will this afternoon publish its findings on the government's response to the pandemic. The report will look at the use of lockdowns to control the spread of the disease and whether the impact of closing businesses and schools was properly assessed. More than 160 people, including the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, gave evidence to the inquiry. One of the world's leading artificial intelligence firms, NVIDIA, has posted record-high quarterly revenues of $57 billion, up 62% from the same quarter a year ago. NVIDIA's results have come as traders try to work out whether investments in AI are leading to a bubble. NHS doctors are set to use artificial intelligence as a second pair of eyes to help them find growths which could become bowel cancer. The technology has been trained to assist doctors during colonoscopies. The National Institute for Health and Care Excellence says the approach has real promise. Meta says it will begin closing the accounts of under-16s in Australia ahead of a ban on children in the country having social media profiles. Firms could be fined up to £25 million if they don't comply with the new rules.
Thank you, Jane. It's now 24 minutes to 7. If Labour does not get to grips with the dilemmas involved in stopping the boats, illegitimate forces will take over. That is the phrase, that is the warning from the Home Secretary. In an interview for my Political Thinking podcast, but we're going to hear some of it at 8:10, listening to it has been Henry Zeffman, our Chief Political Correspondent. Morning to you, Henry. Fascinating to hear Shabana Mahmood, I think, talking about what she calls dark forces that could be at play.
Yeah, really interesting here. She said, if everyone in mainstream politics doesn't want to talk about this, doesn't want to address it, or doesn't have the will to come up with the solutions that are needed, then I do think you leave the space for much darker forces. And she goes on to say that this legitimate discussion could be taken over by forces that are illegitimate. I think what's interesting here is the thrust of this week, where Shabana Mahmood has unveiled an awful lot of policy on asylum, has been about her and the Labour Party being seen to take an issue seriously, which so many potential Labour to reform switchers take seriously. And she's visibly relished the scrap with Nigel Farage on that. For example, Reform UK put out a social media post earlier this week of Shabana Mahmood sitting on a bed wearing Reform UK pyjamas with a poster of Nigel Farage behind her. And both she and Nigel Farage will have been very pleased with that. But actually, what she's saying to you there is not an argument she's making to reform switchers. It's an argument she is making to progressives, especially, I think, some of her parliamentary colleagues who might be uneasy with the direction of travel here, in fact, are uneasy with the direction of travel here, about why she thinks it's important to press ahead.
Controversially, she's taken advice from a hardline government in Denmark, albeit one of the centre-left, but also from Donald Trump's government. And one part of that advice is you have to give lots of money to people who want to get out of the country, and she's signalling she might well do that.
Yeah, really interesting this, because I don't think this was a big feature of some of the detailed policy that she's been talking about earlier this week. But Shabana Mahmood told you that she has asked her officials to pilot a programme, a small programme, she says, where failed asylum seekers are offered significantly more money than they currently are for what's known as a voluntary return, essentially to leave the country. At the moment, the upper limit is about £3,000. But she says she is willing to consider a big increase on that. And the justification she gives is that she says for each asylum seeker in the country, it currently costs £30,000 per individual per year. So she says actually that could be significantly better value for money for the taxpayer.
Henry Zeppman, thank you. Well, are migrants hearing any of this? Andrew Hardy, our Paris correspondent, has been to the coast of France to talk to them, and we'll hear his report at 7:30, and we'll hear from the Home Secretary at 8:10.
It's 21 minutes to 7. Did we lock down soon enough as COVID spread around the world? Were those lockdowns reasonable? Just some of the big questions that the COVID-19 public inquiry has been grappling with as it reports its findings on the government's response to the pandemic, including the role of ministers and senior civil servants. That's as it scrutinises the decision-making right at the top. That's coming later today. Let's just remind ourselves of what Boris Johnson had to say when giving evidence to the inquiry in 2023.
The possibility of a coronavirus pandemic, which was only declared by the WHO on the 12th of March, it hadn't really broken upon the political world, certainly in my consciousness. I wasn't asked about it, for instance, at all at PMQs. I look at all this stuff in which we seem so oblivious with horror now. I mean, we should have twigged. We should collectively have twigged much sooner. I should have twigged.
We should have twigged much sooner. Jim Reid, our health reporter, who's been following the COVID inquiry very closely. What is the significance of today's findings and report?
Morning, Emma. I mean, I think the report today is going to be dense. It's going to be detailed. I think it's going to be around 800 pages long, and it's going to cover not just the response of the UK government, but also the devolved nations. So we had weeks of hearings held in Edinburgh, Cardiff and Belfast. In terms of the areas it's going to look at, you mentioned that the timing of lockdowns, that first one in March 2020, but also crucially the second in the autumn of that year, and also whether enough attention was paid to the impact, really, of those restrictions, particularly on the most vulnerable groups. Also things like government messaging. You might remember some of those hard-hitting adverts at the time. Did they work? Were they counterproductive? It will look at the actions of individual officials. So, for example, Partygate, other cases of alleged rule breaches by officials, what effect they might have had on public confidence. We do know a number of letters have been sent out in advance of this report today to individuals who will be named, warning them they will be criticised. Obviously, we don't know the extent to that criticism and why, at least until this report is published at 4 p.m. this afternoon.
And based on where we are with the inquiry so far and the impact it's having, what impact could this have?
I mean, this whole inquiry is huge. It's already cost around £200 million. It's divided into 10 separate sections covering different topics. So the one today is on political decision making. We've already had a previous set of findings back in July, actually last year, looking at the planning for a pandemic. That was particularly critical, those findings and the recommendations that were made. 10 recommendations made at the time, all quite critical. And as a result of that, actually, we're in the middle of one of the government say, the largest pandemic training exercise that's ever been held in this country, something called Exercise Pegasus. We should see the results of that last year. So the government would say, and I think the inquiry would say, we are seeing some results already of the recommendations that have been put in place.
Well, a reminder, you can catch up on a lot more from Jim. Jim Reid, thank you, our health reporter, and other reports on our COVID inquiry podcast. If you want to get all of that detail and remind yourself of it and keep getting the updates, you can search for it on BBC Sounds.
17 minutes to 7 now. This moment is nothing short of monumental, the family of Virginia Roberts Giuffre declares, as President Trump signed into law the bill to release all government files on Jeffrey Epstein, something he consistently resisted until this week. I asked our North American correspondent David Willis how significant a moment it was.
Highly significant, Nick. There's normally, of course, a fair degree of spectacle when Donald Trump signs a major piece of legislation into law. They get reporters and photographers crammed into the West Wing to watch the president apply his signature with that familiar black Sharpie. But everybody conspicuously absent media-wise when it came to the signing of the Epstein Files Transparency Act this evening, and the announcement that it had indeed happened was confined to a post on the president's Truth Social media platform, in which he went to some lengths to tie Jeffrey Epstein to a string of leading Democrats, including Bill Clinton and the former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers. And he added that perhaps the truth about these Democrats and their associations with Jeffrey Epstein will soon be revealed. And I think that was perhaps to be expected, Nick, because this was a bill that President Trump never wanted to put his name to. He doggedly resisted the release of the files relating to the activities of his former friend until as recently as last weekend. But he was facing the biggest rebellion of his presidency in Congress, and so suddenly had to reverse course, abandon his opposition to the bill. That prompted that rare display of bipartisan unity on the part of Congress, which voted almost unanimously on Tuesday to force the Department of Justice to make those files public.
This U-turn has happened very quickly, with all its stages going through within days, David, as you say. Do we know how quickly we'll see the files themselves?
That remains to be seen. The Justice Department has 30 days, Nick, in which to release these files to the public. But the question then is how many of them will actually be released. The Attorney General, Pam Bondi, said today that the US Justice Department would follow the law. But this bill, passed by Congress, signed into law by Donald Trump, allows for the withholding of any information that could jeopardize an active or ongoing investigation in relation to Jeffrey Epstein. And just last Friday, President Trump ordered a federal investigation into Epstein's links to his, Donald Trump's, Democratic political opponents.
David Willis, our North America correspondent, thank you.
It's 14 minutes to seven. Now, it may feel like the budget's already been gone in terms of the anticipation for it, but at Prime Minister's Questions, Kemi Badenoch was still trying to nail down the government's plans on tax. But what really cheered everyone up was thinking about the football, just as we were doing a great deal yesterday on Today. Well, here's Yesterday in Parliament with our parliamentary correspondent, Susan Hume.
For a Prime Minister languishing in the popularity polls, you can see the attraction of the fairy tale comeback. Past failure, all forgotten, thanks to a spectacular bicycle kick into the back of the net and a couple more slotted in at the final moment for a 4-2 victory.
Mr Speaker, let me start by congratulating Scotland on their magnificent victory last night, qualifying for the World Cup for the first time since 1998.
MPs yelled like they were on the terraces. Perhaps for the first time ever, the SNP cheered something a Westminster Prime Minister said. But sadly for Sir Keir Starmer, the opposition leader didn't want to talk about football.
Can the Prime Minister tell us why his government is the first government in history to float increasing income tax rates only to then U-turn on it all after the actual budget?
She perhaps meant to say before the actual budget, although it certainly has been a confusing time. With a grin, Keir Starmer seized on the last bit.
I'll inform you the budget's actually next week rather than after the budget. So we've only got 1 week to go. But I can tell her it'll be a Labour budget, Mr Speaker, with Labour values. That means we will concentrate on cutting NHS waiting lists, cutting debt and cutting the cost of living.
Kemi Badenoch reiterated that the budget was unravelling before it had even happened.
The Chancellor's cluelessness, I'm afraid, is damaging the economy now. The Prime Minister needs to end this shambles. So can he confirm today that he won't break another promise by freezing income tax thresholds? Yeah.
Income tax and national insurance thresholds have been frozen for the past few years from when the Conservatives were in government. That means as people's wages go up, even if it's only in line with inflation, they pay more tax. But the Prime Minister did not explicitly rule out extending the freeze.
The budget is 1 week today and we will lay out our plans. But what we won't do, Mr Speaker, I've said what we will do in terms of protecting the NHS and public services. What we won't do is inflict all austerity on the country as they did.
Kemi Badenoch knew what she took from that.
It is quite clear that they are going to freeze thresholds. We didn't get a clear answer from them, but this is really important.
Sitting beside the Prime Minister, Rachel Reeves looked on with a rather tight smile as Kemi Badenoch reminded her of what she'd said at last year's budget.
And I quote, "I am keeping every single promise on tax that I made in our manifesto. So there will be no extension of the freeze in income tax and national insurance thresholds." Why was freezing thresholds a breach of the manifesto last year, but it isn't this year?
Yes. Prime Minister. Mr Speaker, every week she comes along and speculates and distorts. Recession. And what do we get? The fastest growing economy in the G7 in the first half of the year.
This time Rachel Reeves smiled more warmly and nodded. The Lib Dem leader, Sir Ed Davies, suggested one area ripe for tax reform.
Every year there are more than 300 suicides related to problem gambling. It affects hundreds of thousands of families, tearing them apart. Meanwhile, online gambling firms are taking in record revenues of over £7 billion a year.
He suggested taxing online gambling firms on their UK profits so that they'd still have to pay even if they registered for tax overseas. Still basking in Tuesday night's Scotland football result, the Labour MP Torkel Crichton wanted travel tips for next summer.
When the Prime Minister next meets with the President of the United States, can he ask him if he knows any reasonably priced hotels near the MetLife Stadium in New Jersey? Where the World Cup final is to be held?
But you just can't get away from the budget right now.
And as we are about to provide the biggest boost to whisky exports since our trade deal was signed, can he ask the Chancellor to gently consider excise duties next week so we Scots can continue celebrating at reasonable prices?
The Prime Minister said it was important the government did everything it could to support Scotch whisky. Something Torkel Crichton's planning to do too, in a very real way.
Former colleague in political reporting, Torkel Crichton, who moved into politics. Who's new reporting there on Yesterday in Parliament? It's now 7:09.
Across England, the majority of the 24 centres that provide mental health support on a drop-in basis for 11 to 25-year-olds have said that they'll be forced to significantly reduce services or close entirely when government funding comes to an end next year. The government says it's setting up something called Young Future Hubs to address the needs in a bid to help those with lower level mental health issues before they develop into more serious problems. Let's hear from Arthur, who's used an early support hub in Barnstaple, Devon. A year ago, he was in the middle of a mental health crisis, but he says the service turned his life around and now he's started an electrical apprenticeship.
Probably one of the best things about it is that it's actually physical, because you can just walk in there and then you can get help. Because I kind of like dashed between all the services in the local area, like begging for help. And I kind of just got played hot potato with, and then no one really helped me. I'm not trying to say a sob story, but it literally was pure medical neglect. The system's really bad. It's like most places just like watch you drown and just hold your hand. But like this actually did like pull you out and help you genuinely.
Leila Moran listening to that on the line, a Liberal Democrat MP, of course, and a chair of the Health Select Committee. Good morning.
Good morning.
We can hear the importance of these pilot drop-in centres. The government's talked about moving now to a new system, the Young Future Hubs. What do you see as the issue?
So, I mean, you just heard it in the voice of that young person, you know, it's deeply concerning. He used words like begging and feeling like a hot potato. This is a sadly very common experience, not just in children's mental health, but adult mental health too. And the Health Select Committee is running an inquiry into adult mental ill health currently. And we are very interested in the children's space. It will be the same for both. The system at the moment is completely broken. And for children, if you consider mental health the Cinderella service of the physical health service, often children's services are the Cinderella services of those, and you see it in the statistics. I think it's 250,000 children are waiting on NHS waiting lists for over a year. So there is desperate need. I think everyone would have welcomed and do welcome the Young Futures Hub's idea. I don't think they had realised, and perhaps it isn't, because we don't have the full picture about what they're going to look like, that it would be an either or with these early support hubs. And what we've learned in our inquiry, which we've yet to publish, so I hope to come back to talk to you about it, but these one-stop shops are the way to go. And the reason for that is it stops people feeling like they are a statistic, a hot potato, as that young person described it. Instead, they present as a person. When they get there, they get treated for the whole of their life. If they need help with housing, if they need help with school,
I can hear that. But what's wrong with the Young Futures Hubs being instead of?
It should be as well as.
Yes,
the need is enormous, and that's the concern. And what I'm hearing from the sector is, unless they get certainty over the future of their funding, there's 24 of these hubs. There are more across the country. But unless they hear soon, they're going to have to start losing some of their expertise. They'll have to start serving redundancy notices. So the government needs to be clear about what they're doing with this. I would urge them to have a conversation with the centre sooner than later to give them that certainty. And ideally, we need to be finding a system that starts to tackle the root causes of why we seem to have such a crisis in children's mental ill health, which has, I'm afraid, deteriorated over the last 3 years and is an issue that needs urgent addressing by government and the whole of society.
Leila Moran, thank you.
It's now 5 to 7. Divisions here over the war in Gaza are so deep that three quarters of people don't feel comfortable talking about the issue at all. Some would consider ending friendships over the issue. And those with strong views on the conflict have switched off from mainstream media altogether. That's the finding of new research by the polling organisation More in Common. Its UK director, Luke Trill, joins us. Deep, deep divisions you're reflecting here, Luke.
Yes, absolutely. So we have been tracking attitudes to the conflict in Gaza since October the 7th, 2023. And what we found is that while the majority of Brits do not pick one side over another, they tend to worry about civilians suffering on both sides of the conflict. Amongst those who do pick a side, they have started to feel increasingly personally negative about people who hold opposing points of view. So 4 in 10 of those who say they sympathize more with the Israeli side or the Palestinian side, for instance, say they would end a friendship with someone who posted on social media in support of the other side.
You also have rather startling and shocking findings about how unsafe British Jewish people feel and how unsafe this country is for Jewish people as perceived by the country as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. So we conducted focus groups with Jewish people around the country, and what we found was Jewish people telling us they no longer felt safe to wear religious clothing out and about because of the rise in anti-Semitism. But amongst the public as a whole, more than 4 in 10 said that they didn't think that Britain was now a safe place for Jewish people. Actually, we also asked about whether Britain was safe for Muslim people, and over a third of people said they no longer felt that Britain was safe for Muslims. So real outsized consequences of people's attitudes to the conflict for social cohesion here in the UK.
Consequences, too, for their trust in organisations like the BBC, and is relevant given what this organisation is going through at the moment. You found that people with strong views simply don't listen or watch or read, not just to the BBC, but anything they might describe as mainstream media.
Yeah, absolutely. Those with the strongest views on either side of the conflict are increasingly opting into their own information sources. So while the majority of Britons think that the BBC has covered the conflict either neutrally or don't express an opinion, amongst those who pick a side, they tend to say that the BBC and other mainstream organisations have had a lean one way or another. And that is meaning that people who sympathise more with the Palestinian side are very often opting into social media to get their news. Those who sympathise more with the Israeli side tending to opt into more right-leaning publications. And of course, when you get to the stage where people are consuming different information sources, it's very hard then to have a constructive conversation about the conflict. Indeed. And they start to ascribe negative motives to the other side. So people on the Palestinian...
Forgive me, we've got to leave it there, I'm afraid, but fascinating. Of more in common, you can read more on their website.
From chilling debate to chilly weather, here's Sarah Keith-Lucas.
Thank you, Emma. Yes, cold Arctic air in force across the UK, bringing us some low temperatures, and we have got warnings for ice and snow in places too. Yellow warnings for anywhere exposed to that cold northerly wind, so anywhere around eastern England, from Suffolk up towards Northumberland. Northern and eastern Scotland also seeing snow showers, as well as Northern Ireland, the far southwest of England and West Wales too. We've also got a higher level amber warning for parts of the North York Moors and Yorkshire Wolds, and it's here we could see 15 to 25 centimetres of snow today, mainly over the higher ground. Elsewhere, if you're in those yellow warning zones around exposed coastal areas, we could see 2 to 5 centimetres of snow and certainly some widespread ice. Away from the warning areas, further inland across England, Wales and parts of southwest Scotland, it's going to be a mostly dry day. We've got a sharp frost out there first thing. Temperatures have been as low as -6 across parts of Cumbria, for instance. But blue sky and sunshine away from those warning areas today. Less windy than it was yesterday. And top temperatures across the northern half of the UK around 2 to 4, 4 to 6 in the south.
Sarah, thank you very much. Fests on. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Emma Barnett.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 20th of November. The headlines this morning. US military officials are in Ukraine where they'll discuss ways of ending the war, with reports suggesting Washington and Moscow have proposed Kyiv should surrender territory. Donald Trump has signed into law a measure to release files on the latest sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And the public inquiry into the COVID pandemic is due to publish its report into the effectiveness of the government's response and the use of lockdowns.
Coming up in the next hour, a view from the French beaches of Britain's new asylum plans.
Do you know the rules are changing in England to make it harder for people like you to stay? Nothing will stop me from going to England, he says.
And most of us can probably recognise the very distinctive style of a beautiful Wes Anderson film, but the director of Grand Budapest Hotel and the Royal Tenenbaums and Fantastic Mr. Fox, I could go on, he tells us it's not deliberate.
I think the next film I make, it may be less immediately recognisable as mine, but I always think that.
Can't help it. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
American military officials will hold talks in Ukraine on efforts to end the war, amid some reports that Washington and Moscow have held discussions without Kyiv and are proposing that it should make major territorial concessions. There's been no official comment from Washington, but the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio called for both sides to put forward realistic ideas. From Washington, here's our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman.
President Trump's plan, not only for a truce but a full end to the war, has barely budged since his Alaska summit with Vladimir Putin in August. This latest reported attempt to revive a framework for negotiations followed discussions between Mr. Trump's aide, Steve Witkoff, and Mr. Putin's envoy, Kirill Dmitriev, according to unnamed officials quoted by the news website Axios. The proposal would reportedly require Ukraine to make sweeping concessions, including surrendering the Donbass region and limiting the size of its military. Moscow has made these demands before, and they are seen by Kyiv as capitulation. The US State Department would not comment on the reports, and the Secretary of State Marco Rubio has not directly addressed them, but in a social media post wrote of the need for an exchange of realistic ideas and concessions from both sides. Washington has recently toughened its stance on Moscow with new sanctions and could be preparing to press President Zelensky harder over what he and his European allies have always regarded as red lines.
Ukraine says about 1,800 children who were captured by Russia during the war have been reunited with their families without Moscow's involvement or even knowledge. The number represents a fraction of the estimated 20,000 children who are missing. Kyiv won't be drawn on how the children have been rescued. Their forcible removal led to the International Criminal Court issuing an arrest warrant for the Russian leader, Vladimir Putin. Our correspondent James Waterhouse reports.
The return of captured Ukrainian children has even been a priority for the US First Lady, Melania Trump, who last month said eight made it home after what she described as an open channel of communication with Vladimir Putin. But the numbers being rescued are still low, and Kyiv blames a lack of pressure being put on Moscow to cooperate. Now Ukraine's presidential office has told the BBC that almost all the returned 1,800 children made it back without any Russian involvement or knowledge. It claims the Kremlin only complicates the process by moving the children and changing their identities. The International Criminal Court has charged Vladimir Putin with the forced abduction of children, but some ICC members have chosen to ignore his arrest warrant during his official visits.
Donald Trump says he has signed into law the bill to release the files on the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein after making a U-turn. Mr. Trump had long resisted calls to make the information public, saying it was part of a Democrat hoax. But pressure from his supporters led him to back moves to publish the documents. The president, who was once friends with Jeffrey Epstein, insists he knew nothing about the paedophile financier's crimes. Our North America correspondent David Willis reports.
A degree of spectacle normally accompanies Donald Trump's signing of a major piece of legislation, but reporters and photographers weren't invited to witness the president applying his signature to the Epstein Files Transparency Act. President Trump had doggedly resisted the release of files relating to the criminal activities of his former friend until as recently as last weekend. On Sunday, however, facing the biggest rebellion of his presidency in Congress, he capitulated, prompting a near unanimous vote to publish the documents. The Justice Department now has 30 days in which to comply with the law, but the big question is how many of the files will actually be released. The bill allows for the withholding of material that could compromise an ongoing investigation. And just last Friday, President Trump ordered an inquiry into Epstein's links to several of his Democratic opponents.
The public inquiry into the COVID pandemic will this afternoon publish its findings into the government's response. It will offer its assessment of the unprecedented use of lockdowns to control the spread of the disease from March 2020. More than 160 people have given evidence, including the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
In a report of around 800 pages, the inquiry's chair, Baroness Hallett, will examine the decisions made by the UK government and devolved administrations. It'll look at whether lockdowns were timely and reasonable, whether ministers considered how they would affect people, and whether there was effective communication with the public. Baroness Hallett is also due to cover public confidence in the measures imposed and breaches of the rules and standards, including by ministers and officials. She'll set out recommendations for policymakers.
The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has warned that mainstream politicians must discuss border security and immigration, or they'll let the country down by allowing extremists to dominate the debate. In an interview with Nick Robinson on Political Thinking, she also defended a pilot scheme offering higher payments to failed asylum seekers if they leave the country voluntarily. Ms. Mahmood rejected suggestions that Reform UK was winning the debate on immigration.
They're making mischief, but it's me that's living now rent-free in their heads because I'm a politician that's willing to both acknowledge a problem and have the solutions that are needed to fix it. They just need an issue to exploit, and that is what I will deny them with every fibre of my being, because I'm not willing to cede this territory to forces on the extremes or forces that are beyond the pale on the far right.
You can hear the full interview on Political Thinking on Radio 4 on Saturday afternoon at 5:30 and on BBC Sounds. One of the world's leading artificial intelligence firms, NVIDIA, has reported better than expected quarterly revenue of $57 billion, reflecting strong demand for its sophisticated chips. The California-based company also recorded a profit of more than $31 billion. NHS doctors say they plan to use AI to spot growths that could lead to bowel cancer. The National Institute for Health and Care Excellence has said five technologies should be made available, while more evidence is gathered on whether they save lives. The disease is the UK's fourth most common cancer. Here's our health and science correspondent, James Gallagher.
During a colonoscopy, a tiny camera is guided through the bowel so doctors can hunt for small growths called polyps. These can become cancerous, so are normally removed during the procedure. Artificial intelligence software has been trained on thousands of images of polyps, so now it can also watch the video feed and act like a second pair of eyes looking for unusual growths. The National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, known as NICE, said there was clear evidence that AI helped to discover more polyps.
The technology firm Meta, which owns Instagram, Facebook and Threads, says it's shutting down the accounts of Australians who are under 16. A ban on this group using social media, which is due to come into force later next month, has been criticised by the companies. They could be fined up to £25 million if they don't comply. Here's our Australia correspondent, Katie Watson.
Teenagers across Australia woke up to the news they'll be kicked off popular social media platforms sooner than they'd expected. From today, Meta says it will begin notifying children under 16 that access to Instagram, Facebook and Threads will be blocked from December the 4th and that they won't be able to create new accounts either. The ban, which comes into force 6 days later, will also affect platforms including TikTok, YouTube, X and Reddit. Meta said in a statement that while it agreed with the government that online spaces needed to be safe and age-appropriate, it didn't believe a ban cutting teens off from their friends was the answer, arguing that it could also lead to fewer safeguards in place for young people online.
Katie Watson reporting.
Jane, thank you. It's 9 minutes past seven. It's taking a lot longer than he thought. President Trump, having said he could end the war in Ukraine in a single day, is still trying to do so. Senior US military officials are in Ukraine today for talks on trying to do that and are expected to meet President Zelensky. This against a backdrop of unconfirmed reports that US and Russian officials have created a new peace plan with major concessions that have long been said to be red lines for Ukraine, including ceding the whole of the Donbas region and halving the size of its armed forces. That's something our next guest denies, saying appeasement is never a peace plan. He has a fair idea of how the land lies politically in Ukraine and Washington, having served as the US ambassador to Ukraine in 2006 to 2009 and as a senior diplomat at the US embassy in Kyiv during President Trump's first term. I started by asking William B. Taylor what weight he gave to these reported peace plans.
I'm skeptical of those stories. These proposals that have been circulating around that are very lopsided in favor of the Russians are not credible. There have been a couple of articles that describe what's purported to be the result of some secret conversations between Americans and Russians over the past, maybe a couple of weeks or even months, that would have the Ukrainians give up territory that the Russians have been trying to take but have failed to take for 2 years. It would require the Ukrainians to limit the size of their military. It would require the Ukrainians to reject any assistance coming from the United States or from Europe. This is crazy, Emma. This makes no sense. I put very little credibility into these reports.
So in terms of the way forward then, what do you think it is at the moment? How do you see it?
The way forward, I believe, is not glamorous. It is to put pressure on Putin to stop the war. And President Trump has started to do that. He's been putting sanctions on Russian oil companies, big Russian oil companies, which he hadn't done prior, and that President Biden didn't do earlier. But that's now happened. President Trump has done that, and it's already starting to have an effect of reducing the revenues going into the Russian economy that the Russians used to fund the war. That's on the economic side. On the military side, the possibility of supporting these long-range fires, long-range strikes into military targets into Russia. And the last thing, Emma, that I think is important to convince Putin that he cannot win is for the Europeans, and then followed by the Americans, to figure out a way to provide the Ukrainians with that $200 to $300 billion of Russian central bank money that's been frozen in mostly Belgian banks. Those are, I think, very important to convince Putin, he cannot win. He's going to have to stop the war.
And just looking at this now, I mean, it's very clear with what he said at the beginning, with what President Trump said when he came into office versus where he is now. It's proving a lot more difficult than he thought, to say the very least. How optimistic are you that anywhere can be reached quickly?
You're right. It's more difficult than he thought. He thought he could do it in a day, he said. He's figured it out. It's very complicated. Optimistic about a pressure. President Trump has leverage. He's used that leverage in terms of sanctions, and Putin knows it. And Putin panicked when President Trump put secondary tariffs on the Indians for buying Russian oil back this summer. That panicked Putin because he knows that that's going to be trouble for him if those sanctions come into effect. And Putin, you know, got on the phone, got a meeting in Ankara. And the same thing happened, Emma, when President Trump was talking about providing Tomahawks to the Ukrainians. President Putin panicked, got a phone call in with President Trump. Both of those things demonstrate that that Putin's vulnerable and that Trump has leverage. He just has to decide to use it.
Do you think he's going to now?
We'll see. I don't know. I'm not. I haven't talked to him. but he's got.
I suppose it's that delay that some would view it as that has caused the doubt as to where he's going to put the emphasis if there was a deal to be done, and the concerns around giving much more to the Russians than should be given, than is fair to be given, a lopsided deal, as you put it. That perhaps is part of the reason why some are cynical about this and are concerned, and perhaps are giving more credence to those reports that you've dismissed.
I do believe that President Trump wants to end this war. And he's been saying that he's consistent with that goal. A lopsided agreement along the lines that we've been talking about, that, yes, I do dismiss, it would not end the war. It would be a bad agreement. It would not end the war. They don't give peace prizes for appeasement, Emma, as you know. And that's what it would be. It would be an appeasement.
William B. Taylor, thank you very much for your time.
It's now 7:14. Days after the boss of Google warned that the AI bubble could burst, the chipmaker NVIDIA, the company which manufactures the chips on which AI depends, is booming. The latest financial results for the world's most valuable public traded firm show revenues up 62% since the same time last year. Let's talk about that with the founding partner at Passion Capital, tech investor Eileen Burbridge, who joins us on the line. The bubble isn't bursting for NVIDIA, isn't it? Why are they so dominant?
Well, their chips are the ones that are most widely used for these AI models and for training artificial intelligence models. And that's what software developers are using for their models. And then that's also what's powering data centers then that are actually being used to run the models when consumers or developers are using those same models.
$65 billion expected in this quarter. It is vast sums of money.
It is enormous, as is the company's market capitalization. As you mentioned, it's now the world's most valuable publicly traded company, even though it's come down a bit from its peak earlier this year, worth about $4.5 trillion.
Yeah. And is it sustainable, do you think?
That's a great question. It's a $4.5 trillion question, Nick.
If I knew,
I'd be busy buying or selling or doing something else. But, you know, it is at the moment being sustained by the fact that its chips dominate, and the fact that everybody seems to want to make sure that it's got enough access to this compute power, that they're buying access to the infrastructure. What'll really underpin its sustainability is whether or not there's enough actual energy to power these data centers and the facilities, and whether or not the software development that's going into it generates enough utility and enough value for people that it ends up becoming as important or as impactful as we all or most people tend to think it will be.
And although it's a huge trade and it's booming, it's still a handful of companies that are benefiting from this.
At the moment, yes. It's sort of in the order of 10 to 20 companies. And a lot of what's fueling some of the skepticism or concern about a bubble is that there seem to be a lot of circular deals going on, whereby NVIDIA is committing to invest in a company, which in turn is committing to invest in NVIDIA chips, or to, you know, put forward purchase orders for chips or commit to buy more chips from NVIDIA. And so it goes around and around, maybe with one or two other people inside the circle. But yes, it's about sort of 10 to 20 companies that all seem to have these deals going back and forth.
Eileen Burbage of Passion Capital, thank you.
It's 17 minutes past seven. Let's go back to Sean for another angle from the UK boss of Ford, which says a pay-per-mile charge for electric vehicles would be the wrong policy at the wrong time. Sean, good morning again.
Yes, hi. So in next Wednesday's budget, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, could be looking at increased levies for electric vehicles, possibly 3 pence per mile driven, as was first reported by The Telegraph. This was another of the things I asked Ford's chair and managing director in the UK, Lisa Brankin, about, and the potential consequences of this policy.
When you drive a petrol vehicle, you pay fuel duty and you pay that as you pay for your fuel at the pump. You don't have any knowledge of paying it. It just happens as you pay for your fuel. It's a tax, but it's not very transparent. The implementation of the pay per mile, you obviously at some point we need to normalise electric taxation versus petrol or diesel, but this doesn't feel like the right time to do it. And what it's doing is it's calling out electric mileage in a very different and separate way, and it kind of adding an admin burden onto electric car buyers that your petrol or diesel equivalent doesn't have. So we understand as an industry that we need to find a way to normalise this, but we would ask for it to be done in an equitable way. So if the government are kind of reviewed everything altogether and said we're going to implement this scheme for everybody and do it in the same way, that kind of works. What we're doing is calling out electric vehicle drivers as, if you like, a special case, making a really visible payment for that they have to make, and adding an extra admin burden onto them that I think that in the face of really fragile demand for electric vehicles is just another break. And we've certainly seen through some of our dealer businesses, customers who had placed orders put them on hold or cancel pending what happens in the budget. So I think it's very concerning, because we've just actually had an electric car grant implemented, which was really, really fantastic and great news for us. But now we then have this, which is a break against that, which just doesn't seem the right thing, and it's certainly not the right time to do it.
What's at risk?
If everything that's moot in the budget comes, I think what we just see is just a further suppression of demand for electric vehicles, which we absolutely don't need at the moment.
And you say you don't need it because you reflected that customers have those concerns about electric cars already. What are they worried about?
People are worried about charging, number one. Some of them are worried about range and the practicality of an electric vehicle. Some are worried about running costs. Some are worried about what happens if you run out of charge on the motorway or whatever. We're trying to sell to the customers at the moment who have the easiest adoption rates, but there are use cases that are more challenging. That's very true in the commercial vehicle world as well, where the functional requirements of every vehicle can't really be well met by an electric vehicle. So if you carry heavy loads long distances, a battery electric vehicle just isn't really suitable for that at the moment.
Lisa Brankin there of Ford. Remember, you can hear that whole interview on BBC Sounds. Search for Big Boss Interview.
Sean, thanks very much. It's 20 past seven. Writers worry at the best of times. Deadlines, creativity, nervousness about putting their ideas and stories into the world. Now, a new report has revealed around half of published novelists in the UK have another fear, artificial intelligence, and that it will replace their work entirely. Dr. Clementine Collett from Cambridge University's Mindery Centre for Technology and Democracy is the lead researcher on this study and author of the report, but also a novelist herself, so some empathy perhaps. Her first book came out in 2023. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma. It's great to be here.
One of the big concerns there, I mean, a headline I've said, concern about AI, but specifically, what have they said? What is the real fear?
Yes, so this is based on research with nearly 400 literary creatives across the UK. And the long and short of it is that novelists and those in publishing are really worried about generative AI, and they are already feeling the negative effects. So as you said, just over 50% of novelists agree that it's likely that generative AI will displace their work entirely. And 39%, so almost 4 in 10 of novelists, have also said that they've already feeling the negative impacts.
In what way?
Well, there are three ways that they're kind of feeling, three kind of reasons why they're feeling the impact on their income. The first is because of competition with generated material online. The second is sabotage. They feel that AI bots are writing them kind of botched reviews, or maybe publisher, you know, saying that online their books are there, which are under their name, this kind of false material. And thirdly, because of the way that it's changing our attention spans and how we consume, the kind of rise of personalization has moved us away from the long form and towards the short form.
Is there also the concern that, you know, and I mean this with respect and great respect for writers, that certain genres, certain books, because of how AI can learn, do have some level of format, and that they will be reproducible in some ways?
Yes, definitely. So the reports found that within the industry, genre fiction is thought to be more at risk of displacement, so romance, thrillers and crime specifically, than literary fiction. Of course, this is based on the assumption that those genres are more formulaic. But firstly, you know, that is an assumption, and genre writers are amazing at bringing in these kind of elements of surprise and novelty to their work. And also, we don't know what generative AI is going to be able to do in the future in terms of producing more original content. Of course, this is really important, you know, for two reasons. The first is that the novels are such a bedrock of our thriving British creative industry, which brings in $126 billion to our economy every year. And also, they're so vital for our culture, our society, our well-being and our connection to one another. So they're really the core, you know, a core part of our humanity.
Now, if you put into certain AI engines, we can get up a sample of your work at the beginning.
Yes.
Have you done that? A sample chapter or opening compared to your novel itself and your writing?
Yeah. Someone do that in one of my focus groups, put it in to write in my style.
How did it measure up?
It was uncanny. Yeah, it was uncanny. It really had a lot of the kind of same linguistic tropes that I guess I would use in my writing. And I can see that my book is on the LibGen database when I search it there. So,
I mean, psychologically, that's going to possibly wreak havoc for writers who are already aware of themselves and perhaps overthink things, dare I say, sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. I think that it is a psychological impact, you know, as well as a financial one that authors are feeling. And this is a real cry from novelists and literary creatives across the UK, a cry for the government to do something and to put guardrails around AI to protect this incredible industry and thriving industry that we have.
Do you think, though, just looking ahead, there could be a two-tier element to this in the future, that it becomes almost a luxury item to have a book written by a person versus a computer?
Exactly. That is a real concern from literary creatives, that we will have a two-tier market, more so than we have already, where human written work will be, you know, more expensive, a luxury item. Those who can afford it will read human written novels, and AI generated content will be cheap or free, and that will potentially have big societal implications as well.
Dr. Clementine Collett, thank you, and it's good to talk to the real you.
And here is the real Mike with the sport.
Except no imitations, Nick. Let's start with football, shall we? Much needed victory for Arsenal last night in the Women's Champions League. They beat Real Madrid 2-1 thanks to two goals from Alessia Russo. Defeat, though, for Manchester United. They were beaten 5-2 by the former champions Wolfsburg. Tonight, Chelsea have a tough test against Barcelona. You can watch that match on the BBC iPlayer and hear it on BBC Sounds. Now, let's talk cricket, because this time tomorrow we will be about to start the third session of the first day of the first Ashes test in Perth. So roughly 19 hours to go until it all gets underway. Both captains have been speaking to the media overnight. So let's hear from the England skipper Ben Stokes. What does this famous old series mean to him?
Well, the Ashes, it's, you know, the history of England v Australia obviously goes back for 140 years. Every series that I've been a part of, whether it be here or back at home in England, it's an amazing thing to be a part of. You know, you put a lot of effort into every single test match, every single series you play, but there's always certain series that I think just take a little bit more out of you physically, mentally, and this is one of those.
Do you talk about it as a team? Do you talk about the history and all of that of the Ashes? Do you sit there and chat about it?
Not really. I think everyone's just aware of it. Everyone knows, you know, we know that there's been some incredible achievements before us, but what we're really focused on is our opportunity to put ourselves and put this team in into the history books and be one of few England teams who've managed to come to Australia and return back with the urn.
Yeah, and it does feel like that. I mean, this is like, not career defining, it sounds a bit over the top, but I mean, as a captain, I mean, captains are known as Ashes winning captains, aren't they? I mean, it just kind of rolls off the tongue. Is it a defining moment for you, do you think, in your captaincy?
Look, I've got no illusions as to how big the series is in the context of my time as England captain. Baz knows that he's under no illusion about his time as England coach, how big the series is, same as Rob Key. So we accepted that. We're embracing what that pressure and everything that comes with that as well. But, you know, we're not sort of fixated on the idea that this is going to be detrimental to what we've given to English cricket in our time. We obviously know the goal that we want to achieve here come mid-January, and we'll be doing everything possible in our powers to achieve that goal. And I know that these series are always picked out of anyone's time as a player, as a captain, coach, whatever it may be. But, you know, all I know is that since I've been given the opportunity to lead this team out, I've given absolutely everything that I possibly can in terms of the physical side, the mental side of being a professional sportsman, and I'll always continue to do that.
Why have England struggled here over the years? What is it about coming to Australia that makes it so difficult?
Australia always have been and always will be a very, very good team wherever they go, and in particular here, you know, England's record over the last, well, since 2010, everyone's aware of. Everyone's been very vocal about that, and we're aware of that as well. We take that on board, but this is our time to put our own mark in Ashes team, and in particular England teams coming to Australia.
That is Ben Stokes in conversation with Jonathan Agnew just a few hours ago. Let's briefly hear now then from the Australian stand-in skipper for this test, Steve Smith. He was asked at a press conference for his reaction to the recent comments from former England spinner Monty Panesar, who'd been telling his former teammates to talk about Smith's role in the Sandpapergate ball tampering scandal of 7 years ago. This was Smith's response.
I'm going to go off topic for a second here. Who of you in the room has seen Mastermind and Monty Panesar on that? Any of you? Yeah? Well, those of you who have, you'll understand where I'm coming from. And those of you who haven't, do yourself a favour because it's pretty comical. Yeah, anyone that believes that Athens is in Germany, that's a start. Oliver Twist is a season of the year and America is a city. Doesn't really bother me, those comments. So, yeah, that's as far as I'll go with that one.
Steve Smith there, bringing up an appearance by Monty Panesar on Mastermind from about a decade ago, which was pretty bad, I have to say. I mean, I can't say, I don't know, have either of you ever done Mastermind?
I've said no, I've chickened out.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Me too, good decision.
I can imagine it is pretty intense.
One question wrong, no one would ever let you.
Exactly,
I was asked to be someone's friend on Celebrity, a Millionaire the other day, and I've said no.
Really?
Absolutely,
even for that. You wouldn't be their phone a friend?
No, I wouldn't be their phone a friend, Mike.
Okay, more Ashes talk to come.
You can call me anytime, it's not on air.
Okay, not for £1 million. Okay, more Ashes talk in the next hour of the programme.
We look forward to it. Now, you may be making breakfast, you may have wolfed it down already, but let's hear about toast of a different kind.
On BBC Radio 4.
The magic was the speed in the early 2000s.
A smartphone that revolutionised email on the go. A bottled water brand launched by a global drinks company. And a video calling app that transformed how we communicate.
These people were kind of groundbreaking. His instincts were so quick.
I'm Sean Farrington, and I'm asking how these businesses ended up toast.
I would never have thought that it would have crashed and burned in such a short space of time.
The new series of Toast with me, Sean Farrington, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starts today at 12:30.
How about the weather? Not toasty, it's blooming cold. Clear and dry in the west, mostly cloudy in the east with scattered snow showers. Rainy later.
Coming up in the next half hour, Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham's on the programme talking about his new £1 billion growth fund.
You're listening to Today. We're on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Nick Robinson at 29 minutes to 8. Jane Steele's got a summary of the news.
Senior Pentagon officials will meet President Zelensky in Ukraine today for discussions on President Trump's efforts to end the war. Unconfirmed media reports say that US and Russian envoys have come up with a set of proposals for restarting negotiations between Kiev and Moscow. They would reportedly require Ukraine to make concessions, including completely withdrawing from the eastern Donbass region and limiting the size of its military. The EU's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, said that for any peace plan to work, it would need to have Ukrainians and Europeans on board. Kyiv says about 1,800 children who were captured by Russia during the war have been reunited with their families without Moscow's involvement or even knowledge. The number represents a fraction of the estimated 20,000 children who are missing. President Trump says he has signed a bill approving the release by the US Justice Department of documents from its criminal investigation into the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. He carried out the U-turn after pressure from supporters and those in his own party. The Justice Department now has 30 days to release the files. The public inquiry into the COVID pandemic will today publish its findings on the government's response to the virus. The inquiry has assessed the implementation of lockdowns and whether the effects of closing businesses and schools was adequately considered. One of the world's leading artificial intelligence firms, NVIDIA, has posted record-high quarterly revenues of $57 billion, up 62% from the same quarter a year ago. NVIDIA's results have come as traders try to work out whether investments in AI are leading to a bubble. NHS doctors are set to use artificial intelligence as a second pair of eyes to help them find growths which could become bowel cancer. The technology has been trained to assist doctors during colonoscopies. The National Institute for Health and Care Excellence says the approach has real promise.
Thank you, Jane. 27 minutes to eight. Are the migrants gathered on or heading to the French coast? Have they heard the new tougher messages coming from the government? Will it lessen their determination to cross the channel to make a better life here? That, in the end, is the test of the new package of measures set out by the Home Secretary to combat illegal migration. We'll be hearing from her at 8:10. But first, we turn to our Paris correspondent, because he's been back to the French coast to hear from those determined to make the journey. He is Andrew Harding, and he joins us now live. Morning, Andrew.
Morning, Nick. Yes, some interesting developments on the French coast. You may have heard about deadly battles between Kurdish and African smuggling gangs in the migrant camps and even on the beaches. There are signs now that a truce could already be helping to reduce the number of deaths in the channel. We're also hearing talk that the French authorities are still mulling ways to intervene at sea to stop at least some boats. But the immediate focus, as you say, is on the numbers. Close to 37,000 people making successful crossings this year so far. And the question, has Britain now come up with new measures that could bring those numbers down?
Just arrived by train in Calais from Paris. It's a journey we make almost every time there's a new announcement from Britain about measures to try to discourage people from getting on board small boats.
Oh, hello, we're BBC.
So we've come now to an area where the migrants gather, often for food, just on the edge of Calais. There must be 200 people here, all young men, a lot of them from Sudan. BBC News.
Go, go.
Go? Go? Okay, we'll go.
1 minute, please.
A bit of a scramble here. Charity's brought some tea along, some water. It's a really cold, wet, windy day. There won't be any crossings. Are you from Sudan?
Yes.
Whereabouts? Darfur?
Yes.
You go to England?
Yeah, of course.
You know they have changed the rules in England to make it harder now?
No, I didn't.
You didn't hear that? It's now you could wait 20 years before you can become resident. So they're making it harder.
Yeah.
Will that stop you from trying to go? Okay, people telling him not to talk. I guess that's one of the smugglers patrolling the queue here. So we've moved away from the queue where the mood is really quite tense. And We're trying now to catch people on their own, where they're more free to talk.
Adam.
Adam. Okay, nice to meet you, Adam. Okay, so I'm using a translation device. Do you know the rules are changing in England to make it harder for people like you to stay? You will now have to wait 20 years before you can become permanent resident. Nothing will stop me from going to England, he says. Nothing at all. What if the war ends in Sudan? Then Britain, under the new rules, can send you back to Sudan. Everything's back to normal in Sudan, then that's great. That's good, he says. So I think the implication there, he's saying, is that he could go back. How old are you, Adam? 19 years old. Okay, so there are two young men here from Senegal. You're still going to try and cross, he says. And then we'll see what happens. We've decided to go, so you can't just change your mind, he's saying. Where are you from?
Syria.
You're from Syria?
Yes.
How old are you?
20.
20. Do you know that the rules are changing in Britain?
Yes, I know.
To make it difficult for you. You have to wait 20 years, maybe.
I know.
But you still
but
try?
But this Shabana Mahmoud...
Yes, the Home Secretary.
This is Camp Britannia. Why said?
Can we translate this, maybe? Let's translate this. Okay. It's a bit unclear. The minister came to Britain as an immigrant.
Yes.
So you think it's unfair? And now she's making decisions against refugees to make it more difficult for us.
Yes.
He's saying, that's not right. You should be sensitive to the plight of immigrants who live abroad. But now that Britain is making it more difficult for people like you, do you still want to go to Britain?
I want to go to Britannia.
But if you go to Britain, they can send you back to Syria because they will say the war is ending or is over there.
No. I want to try.
You're going to try anyway.
Yes. Okay. I want to go.
It's one thing to talk to people here in Calais who are really already set on their journey to the UK. They'll have paid money often to the smugglers and there's no going back for them, it feels. But the bigger issue is whether news about these new measures in the UK spreads further afield to places like Syria, Afghanistan, to South Sudan, to war zones where people are considering where they could go to find safety, starting to save money to make these long journeys heading towards the UK, and whether at some point, perhaps in the months to come, that could affect their decisions and affect the numbers of people trying to cross here.
Andrew Harding reporting there. We're going to hear from Shabana Mahmood at 10 past 8. That migrant is wrong, of course, that she didn't come here as a migrant. She was born in Birmingham, admittedly to Pakistani immigrant parents, and she says, as you will hear at 10 past 8, that that is exactly what qualifies her to say that there needs to be tougher controls on illegal migration.
It is 20 to 8.
One of the stories we've been hearing about this morning is that ban on social media for teens in Australia. Joining us to tell us more about how it's working is our Sydney correspondent, Katie Watson. And people are getting messages already, aren't they, if they are below 16, that their accounts are going to be shut, Katie?
That's right. So the ban comes into force on the 10th of December, but Meta, who owns Instagram, Facebook and Threads, they're already letting users know between 13 and 15 years old by text, email. Their accounts are going to start being deactivated from the 4th of December. So, yeah, teens woke up today realising they're going to be chucked off these platforms earlier than they had expected. Of course, this is a world-leading ban, according to Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, because he wants to get kids off screens and back on the footy fields, as he said, trying to get kids to be kids and try and be on the side of the parents, as he said before.
Kids being kids, they'll try and find a way around it, won't they? Are they already discussing how it is possible to evade the ban?
Well, exactly. So this is one of the big criticisms. There's 9 platforms involved. There are plenty of other platforms. Gaming's not included, and that's been a bit contentious. People wondering why gaming is not part of it. The idea for the government is that it's about trying to stop kind of social interaction. And so that's, I guess, kind of a lot of doom scrolling and algorithms as well. Messaging is also not part of the ban, but there's a lot of criticism that kids are going to find a way around, that they are much better on technology than the people trying to implement this legislation. And really, is this going to be enforceable? But if you speak to a lot of parents here, they would say anything helps to protect them from going online.
We're going to be watching that experiment very carefully. Katie Watson, thanks for joining us.
Yes, I'm coming back to it later in the programme and hearing from some of those affected. 18 minutes to 8, the first ever UK exhibition of the life and work of the film director Wes Anderson opens at the London Design Museum tomorrow. It draws on his extensive personal archive, including props and puppets, many of which haven't been seen before from films such as Fantastic Mr. Fox and the beautiful Grand Budapest Hotel. Nicola Stanbridge went to meet him as he looked around the exhibition for the first time and asked Wes Anderson about his distinctive style.
We're entering the idiosyncratic world of director Wes Anderson. Over 700 objects at the Design Museum retrospective from his 30-year career, showing his meticulous recurring visual style. A look, he says, that still astonishes him.
I remember with the first film I made, as soon as I saw it, I was completely surprised and it seemed nothing like what I expected. I was completely caught off guard because it was just as we had planned it. But the mixture, the chemistry of it was different. So when I see all of this stuff, it's that same experience, but greatly enhanced. I never would have anticipated anything like this. And when we made Fantastic Mr. Fox, right now we're standing in front of these puppets from Fantastic Mr. Fox. Well, we started the film, we didn't know what even Mr. Fox was going to look like. And the result is nothing remotely like anything I would have envisioned.
Produced by 20th Century Fox.
Are you scared of wolves?
Scared? No, I have a phobia of them.
Well, I have a thing about thunder.
Why? That's stupid.
I don't like needles myself.
Where'd you come from again? How'd you get in the sidecar? I feel like I'm losing my mind.
We're surrounded by the most beautiful puppets. A little sidecar and a motorbike. You've got Petey and his banjo, Mr. and Mrs. Fox, and paintings from their yes. den, and all the other characters, which I understand your daughter used to play with.
Yes, well, much of what is here in this exhibition, I kept in storage in our apartment in New York, and then also in England in our basement. Many of these things are objects that I've lived with over the years. And my daughter played with them all the time. And in fact, there's quite a bit of damage that had to be repaired. That's just her work. But she was careful with them. They're fragile.
Let's go through to the Grand Budapest Hotel. It's your most successful box office film, winning BAFTAs and Oscars. And the design is really central to its success. So this is a 3-meter-wide candy pink model.
This miniature hotel, I think the reason we made a miniature hotel is because the research that we did around the movie led us to a place that had all kinds of very specific qualities and that didn't actually exist. It's hard to find something that hasn't changed too much.
Produced by Fox Searchlight Pictures.
Who are you?
I'm Zero, sir. The new lobby boy.
Zero, you say?
Yes, sir.
Well, I've never heard of you, never laid eyes on you. Who hired you?
Mr. Mosher, sir.
Mr. Mosher!
The costumes here, it brings me to what I feel is really the center of the movie, which is the cast. Ralph Fiennes, who holds the entire movie together in every way, and others.
So looking around here, people will see all your ideas, all your secrets. But what AI is doing is taking your distinctive style and mimicking it. Replicating it. So we can see Wes Anderson directs Star Wars, for instance, online. I just wonder how you feel about AI using your work. Does that worry you or interest you?
I would say the one thing that scares me is looking at an AI version of something that's meant to be from me. And so I don't. But AI is, there's a point at which it's just a natural extension of all the computery things we've been doing already. We shoot our films on film, and we make a lot of things by hand, and we use a lot of old-fashioned techniques. But the way these movies are put together, it all becomes digital.
Are you bound to always tell your stories in this distinctive style, do you think?
When I start a film, I'm starting something completely different from anything I've ever done before. I've got a new set of characters, a new setting. It's not necessarily my choice that it ends up being a recognizable style. It just sort of happens that way. And I think the next film I make, it may be less immediately recognizable as mine, but I always think that.
You filmed the wonderful story of Henry Sugar in the UK and other films, and you have a base in the UK. What plans are there for this next project? Is it Roald Dahl again?
It's not Roald Dahl, but I'll say it's English. And, you know, one of my collaborators on it is Richard Ayoade. So we're working on the script together. So it's English.
Wes Anderson talking to Nicola Stanbridge there. It is now 13 minutes to 8. It's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Canon Angela Tilby.
Good morning. On Monday in St. Thomas Church in Leipzig, the world heard for the first time for over 300 years two lost organ pieces by Johann Sebastian Bach. The manuscripts have been discovered in the Royal Library of Belgium in 1992 without any indication of the date of composition or the composer. But they were so like known examples of Bach's early organ work that the director of the Bach Archive in Leipzig set out to establish whether they were, in fact, his. After 30 years' research, he says he's now 99.9% certain that the two organ chaconne in D minor and G minor are genuine Bach compositions. It's an exciting discovery for those of us who love Bach's organ music. For me, being able to play Bach on the organ would have been an achievement beyond my wildest dreams. I did once try to learn to play, but coordinating hands on keyboards and feet on pedals proved beyond me. One of the giveaways in establishing the authorship of the two pieces was that they show Bach's development of the fugue, a fugue being a musical phrase that's repeated and developed in a variety of ways and builds in complexity towards the climax. Bach was a complex character. He could be bad-tempered and over-demanding. He quarrelled over his salary. He was in no way a saint. But in his music, and this was his genius, he rose above himself. More than perhaps any other Western composer, he managed to blend extraordinary mathematical precision with deep human feeling. From his great settings of the St. Matthew and St. John Passion, and to his apparently modest keyboard pieces, there's a message that our world is at the same time both rationally ordered and deeply felt. We are creatures of both head and heart. The fugue form, which repeats and varies itself, always moves onwards. Bach's music, perhaps again more than that of any other Western composer, suggests to me that there's a story going on, a narrative, which we're all part of, whether we recognise it or not. As the music of time progresses, there are discords and dissonances which are not forgotten or easily resolved, yet we remain creatures of hope in spite of the conflicts and tragedies of life. For Bach, the final note is triumph and peace. Not an easy triumph or a bland peace, but one which reflects the core of his faith in a God who loves humanity so much as to become human, and by being human raises us to God. These two new pieces will no doubt become part of the organ repertoire, a discovery that makes it just a bit harder to dismiss the testimony of faith.
That was Thought for the Day with Canon Angela Tilby. It's now 10 to 8.
The Labour Mayor of Greater Manchester is today, just under a week out from his party's highly anticipated budget, to announce what he believes is a new model of economic growth. It's definitely interesting timing for Andy Burman, through something called the Good Growth Fund, to announce the pumping of £1 billion worth of public investment into Greater Manchester. It's funded by national grants and the Greater Manchester Pension Fund, one of the country's largest local government pension schemes, as well as borrowing against retained business rates. He argues at the heart of this announcement is another move away from trickle-down economic theory, that growth will go where it's meant to, and another move towards the state needing to fuel growth. Andy Burnham, Mayor of Greater Manchester, good morning.
Good morning.
Spending your way to growth, it's a serious chunk of public money. Should this be the model across the UK, the state intervening like this?
Well, it's the model we've used in the last decade, Emma, and as a result, Greater Manchester is the fastest growing city region in the country, a place you know well. It's dramatically changed, particularly the city centre, Media City, where I'm talking to you from now. But we would be the first to acknowledge that the growth hasn't gone everywhere. And this is a plan, what we call for good growth, which means, you know, backing places where the market won't lend. I'll give you an example of how we built the confidence to do this. Stockport, we had a mayoral development corporation, but there was a moment a few years ago where the market wouldn't give us the finance needed to bring through one of the major developments linked to Stockport Interchange. So we took a decision then to back Stockport because we believe in it and we believe in its potential. And that's the learning from all of the last decade that we carry into the new one. And say, you know what, now we're going to back all of our places because we believe in their potential, and they surround the fastest growing, most vibrant city in the country. So it's a safe bet, if you like. We believe we can have another decade of growth here that can accelerate the rate of growth that we've already got, but actually take the growth to all people in all places.
There is a concern, though, about exactly what you've just highlighted, whether the intervention, the state intervention, state-funded intervention, only goes where it's needed, as opposed to providing, for instance, more unaffordable housing, more luxury apartments, more skyscrapers, because Manchester's filled with them and they're not all full. So how much of the new housing from this new fund will be affordable?
Well, that's the point, and it's why it's good growth. In the past, we had a situation where, you know, the market's just picking winners and losers, and we can't have a Greater Manchester that grows like that. If you don't intervene, also, you risk over-gentrification. And that's a challenge that people put to us. So, you know, we've obviously watched the growth of London over the years, and we're kind of learning from that and making sure that that doesn't happen. I'll give you a direct example of how the new generation of leaders we have in Greater Manchester, Bev Craig, the brilliant leader of Manchester City Council, she and her colleagues are about to build the first homes for social rent in Manchester City Centre for 40 years on the old Boddington's brewery site. Victoria North is a huge development coming forward under this new good growth plan that will build many truly affordable homes close to the city centre, the Adelphi Village in Salford, the same. So you can see how we are, if you like, doing what the market won't do and making sure we build a Greater Manchester to everybody.
There have been concerns about housing and the fact that there aren't enough affordable homes and the wait times. And, you know, you've been in power for some time, and that's still a major issue. How many new affordable homes are actually being lived in that you have built?
Well, we haven't had a government until recently that has backed social housing. We had a government that was doing quite the opposite. So it was very difficult for us. Some of our councils are building new social homes. I mentioned Salford a minute ago. They are now in surplus, so they're building more social homes than they are losing. And that's happened in recent years. But the same isn't true of all of our councils. So we strongly support the funding that Angela Rayner secured, the £39 billion for social and affordable homes. And that funding will play out in Greater Manchester. So around £2 billion of it will go into building those social homes here over the next decade.
The point is, you didn't answer in terms of how many, because you're not at that point. That's what you're saying. It hasn't been possible. And you're hoping it will be. A pressure on, or perceived pressure, certainly in the Northwest, are refugees also needing homes? And I just wanted to ask you a very clear, straight question. We're going to hear from the Home Secretary just after 8 o'clock. Do you agree that refugees shouldn't have permanent status for 20 years in this country?
Well, I agree that Shabana Mahmood is right to grasp this nettle and have root and branch reform of the system. I agree with that. But I do have a concern about leaving people without the ability to settle. One of the concerns being that if there's a need to constantly check up on the status of countries where people are, you know, have come from, that might limit the ability of the Home Office to deal with the backlog. And it also may leave people in a sense of limbo and unable to integrate. So
Do you think it's a cruel policy
that the Home Secretary is wrong to call for this level of change. What I would say is it's really important on the back of the measures that she's announced, that there is a considered debate. Time is taken to see if consensus can be built around it, because that would be hugely valuable to the country if that could be secured. So I think it's right to debate the proposals.
Yes, but there
and
is
see
a proposal.
But there's more than that.
There's a strong proposal. Refugees shouldn't have permanent status for 20 years in this country. You've just said that will impede their ability to integrate. Do you agree with that particular point? Some in your party are calling it dystopian.
Well, I've just said to you, I have concerns about that particular element of the plans. I think it will, you know, leave people in a position where, you know, they don't know whether they're staying or potentially leaving. And particularly in situations where, you know, people are wanting to work, wanting to contribute, I think, you know, it would be better to stick with the decision of long-term leave to remain. From my point of view, there are other major changes, though, that the system needs. I think on accommodation, the Home Secretary is right to look at that. I think they need to work more through local areas, local authorities, restore more local consultation to the system.
Well, so, perhaps we would expect you to say that as your current role. But if you don't stay as your current role, if you make good on those leadership ambitions that you were honest about earlier this year, only a few months ago, and just mindful of the fact that YouGov polling last month suggests Keir Starmer has a net favourability rating of minus 51, the lowest recorded by YouGov so far. You've had an offer. The Labour MP Clive Lewis has hypothetically offered to stand down as an MP, give you the opportunity to run for his seat. You can return to the Commons and challenge the Prime Minister's leadership. What do you say to his kind hypothetical?
Well, I appreciate the support, but I couldn't have brought forward a plan of the kind that I brought forward today without being fully focused on my role of Mayor of Greater Manchester. And I'm providing leadership on growth, which is what I think the country needs and is helpful to the government right now. And we're doing this in advance of the budget, I hope, to really bring to life the growth story for the government. So, you know, I think the problem, I would just finish by saying this, Emma, what I think part of the country's problem is the political culture of Westminster, which is playing out in front of us right now.
I know, but you've got to have a seat in it to compete. We've got to leave it there, Andy.
We've built a new economy and a new way of doing politics, and that's more of that is what the country needs.
Andy Burnham will talk again. It's very, very cold. Thank you for your time.
How cold? Sarah can tell us.
Good morning. Yes, it's been the coldest night of the season so far across parts of England and Wales. Temperatures have been down at minus 6 degrees. So cold Arctic air with us today, bringing us that mix of some clear blue sky and wintry sunshine, but also some sleet and snow showers. Now, the areas seeing the sleet and snow are around eastern coasts of England, northern and eastern Scotland, Northern Ireland, and around western coasts of Wales and southwest England too. You might see 2 to 5 centimetres of snow over some lower ground, but over the hill 10 centimetres possible. And for the North York Moors, where there's an amber warning in force, there could be as much as 25 centimetres of snow by the end of today. So in those regions seeing the wintry showers, certainly some disruption likely. Could be some power cuts, thunderstorms and some travel delays too. But elsewhere, for many of us, actually the weather looking dry. It is certainly cold and frosty, but some blue sky, some sunshine and temperatures 2 to 4 in the north, 4 to 6 further south.
Sarah, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Nick Robinson. Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 20th of November. The headlines this morning: American military officials are in Ukraine, where they're discussing moves towards peace, with reports suggesting Russia and the United States have drawn up plans for Kyiv to make major concessions. Donald Trump has carried out a U-turn by approving a law to release files on the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has said the mainstream of politics must tackle broader security and immigration, or they risk ceding the issue to extremists.
What I'm addressing is the well of people who are angry and frustrated and who want change and who feel ignored. And I am saying to them, I recognise the thing that's fueling your resentment, that sense of unfairness, is a real thing.
That interview is coming up after the news.
It is indeed. Also coming up, Australian teens getting ready for that ban on them using social media.
I think it's pointless. There's so many better things that they could do to keep children safe. I think no matter what, how hard they try, people are always going to find a way around it.
They will, especially younger people. 80 years on from Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals, are we now in a rules-free world? We'll discuss. But first, the news is read by Jane Steele.
American military officials are in Ukraine for talks on possible ways of ending the war, with some reports suggesting that Washington and Moscow have held discussions without Kiev and are proposing that it make major territorial concessions. There's been no official confirmation, but the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, called for both sides to put forward realistic ideas. The EU's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, said for any peace plan to work, it would need to have Ukrainians and Europeans on board, while the French foreign minister said it was Russia that was standing in the way of peace. From Washington, here's our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman.
President Trump's plan, not only for a truce but a full end to the war, has barely budged since his Alaska summit with Vladimir Putin in August. This latest reported attempt to revive a framework for negotiations followed discussions between Mr. Trump's aide, Steve Witkoff, and Mr. Putin's envoy, Kirill Dmitriev, according to unnamed officials quoted by the news website Axios. The proposal would reportedly require Ukraine to make sweeping concessions, including surrendering the Donbas region and limiting the size of its military. Moscow has made these demands before, and they are seen by Kyiv as capitulation. The US State Department would not comment on the reports, and the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has not directly addressed them, but in a social media post wrote of the need for an exchange of realistic ideas and concessions from both sides. Washington has recently toughened its stance on Moscow with new sanctions and could be preparing to press President Zelensky harder over what he and his European allies have always regarded as red lines.
The former US ambassador to Ukraine, William Taylor, told us the way to end the war was by the US putting pressure on Russia.
President Trump has leverage. He's used that leverage in terms of sanctions, and Putin knows it. And Putin panicked when President Trump put secondary tariffs on the Indians for buying Russian oil back this summer. And the same thing happened when President Trump was talking about providing Tomahawks to the Ukrainians. Both of those things demonstrate that Putin's vulnerable and that Trump has leverage. He just has to decide to use it.
Ukraine says about 1,800 children who were captured by Russia during the war have been reunited with their families without Moscow's involvement or even knowledge. The number represents a fraction of the estimated 20,000 children who are missing. Our correspondent James Waterhouse reports.
The return of captured Ukrainian children has even been a priority for the US First Lady Melania Trump, who last month said eight made it home after what she described as an open channel of communication with Vladimir Putin. But the numbers being rescued are still low, and Kyiv blames a lack of pressure being put on Moscow to cooperate. Now Ukraine's presidential office has told the BBC that almost all the returned 1,800 children made it back without any Russian involvement or knowledge. It claims the Kremlin only complicates the process by moving the children and changing their identities.
Donald Trump says he has signed into law the bill to release the files on the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein after carrying out a U-turn. Mr. Trump had long resisted calls to make the information public, saying it was part of a Democrat hoax. But pressure from his supporters led to him to back moves to publish the documents. The president, who was once friends with Jeffrey Epstein, insists he knew nothing about the paedophile financier's crimes. Our North America correspondent David Willis reports.
A degree of spectacle normally accompanies Donald Trump's signing of a major piece of legislation, but reporters and photographers weren't invited to witness the president applying his signature to the Epstein Files Transparency Act. President Trump had doggedly resisted the release of files relating to the criminal activities of his former friend until as recently as last weekend. On Sunday, however, facing the biggest rebellion of his presidency in Congress, he capitulated, prompting a near-unanimous vote to publish the documents. The Justice Department now has 30 days in which to comply with the law, but the big question is how many of the files will actually be released. The bill allows for the withholding of material that could compromise an ongoing investigation. And just last Friday, President Trump ordered an inquiry into Epstein's links to several of his Democratic opponents.
The public inquiry into the COVID pandemic will this afternoon publish its findings into the government's response. It will offer its assessment of the unprecedented use of lockdowns to control the spread of the disease from March 2020. More than 160 people have given evidence, including the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has warned that mainstream politicians must discuss border security and immigration, or they'll let the country down by allowing extremists to dominate the debate. In an interview with Nick Robinson on Political Thinking, she also defended a pilot scheme offering higher payments to failed asylum seekers if they leave the country voluntarily. Here's our political correspondent, Leila Nathu.
Shabana Mahmood mounted a strong defence of the raft of changes she's made to the asylum system. The package is modelled on a tougher approach taken by Denmark and includes making refugee status temporary and ending housing and financial support. Denmark also offers higher payments than the £3,000 available in the UK to failed asylum seekers to return to their home countries voluntarily. Ms Mahmood said she was willing to consider a big increase to the current payment, saying each asylum seeker in the country cost the taxpayer £30,000 per year, and that a cash incentive to return was often better value for money.
You can hear the full interview now on Political Thinking on BBC Sounds. A report by the group Human Rights Watch claims that Israel's forcible displacement of Palestinians from three refugee camps in the occupied West Bank violates international humanitarian law. More than 30,000 Palestinians were ordered out of their homes in January and February this year during a military operation designed to tackle militant groups involved in attacks on Israeli soldiers and civilians. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams has the details.
10 months after the Israeli military launched Operation Iron Wall, the residents of three refugee camps, Jenin, Tul Karim and Nur Shams, remain displaced, not knowing when they will be allowed to go home. In the meantime, according to Human Rights Watch, more than 850 homes and other buildings have been destroyed or heavily damaged. Israel says it's been dismantling what it describes as terrorist infrastructure in the camps, but it's also been demolishing whole rows of houses to create new military access routes, which means that thousands of Palestinians no longer have homes to return to. Human Rights Watch says the forced, prolonged evacuations amount to ethnic cleansing and that Israel's actions violate the Geneva Conventions.
The Office for Students predicts that almost half of universities in England will be in deficit by next summer, despite the loss of thousands of jobs across higher education. Universities UK, which represents the sector, has also warned the finances of universities will be damaged by a tax on the income from international students. The Department for Education says it's taken action to put the sector on a secure footing. Here's our education editor, Bramwyn Jeffries.
This report shows the most academically selective universities in England, including those in the Russell Group, have accepted 10% more UK students than last year to shore up their finances. But they're offering fewer postgraduate places to international students who pay much higher fees. This includes a significant drop of 11% in offers to students from China, who mainly choose these research-intensive universities. The Office for Students says a proposed 6% tax on the income from international students would cost England's universities up to £780 million a year. More details about which courses would be eligible for student maintenance grants from the tax are expected in the budget next week.
The technology firm Meta, which owns Instagram, Facebook and Threads, says it's shutting down the accounts of Australians who are under 16. A ban on this group using social media, which is due to come into force later next month, has been criticised by the companies. The firms could be fined up to £25 million if they don't comply. Here's our Australia correspondent Katie Watson.
Teenagers across Australia woke up to the news they'll be kicked off popular social media platforms sooner than they'd expected. From today, Meta says it will begin notifying children under 16 that access to Instagram, Facebook and Threads will be blocked from December the 4th and that they won't be able to create new accounts either. The ban, which comes into force 6 days later, will also affect platforms including TikTok, YouTube, X and Reddit. Meta said in a statement that while it agreed with the government that online spaces needed to be safe and age-appropriate, it didn't believe a ban cutting teens off from their friends was the answer, arguing that it could also lead to fewer safeguards in place for young people online.
Katie Watson reporting.
Thank you, Jane. It's 8:10. Emma's going to be talking more about that ban in Australia at 8:30. Meantime, illegal migration. If we fail to deal with this crisis, will draw more people down a path that starts with anger and ends in hatred. That is Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood's response to those who accuse her of stoking divisions with a proposed crackdown on illegal migration, which tears up Britain's approach to refugees over many decades. Earlier on the programme, Greater Manchester's Mayor Andy Burnham made his discomfort with one of the biggest changes clear. Earlier in the week, Lord Dubs, Alf Dubs, who escaped the Nazis fleeing here on the Kinder transport, told us he thought the Home Secretary was using children as weapons. And yesterday, the Albanian Prime Minister, Edi Rama, who was angered by her singling out Albanian families still living here as targets for deportation, questions how, as he put it, a Labour minister could so poorly echo the rhetoric of the populist far right. Shabana Mahmood, the daughter of Pakistani immigrants and a devout Muslim, told the Commons that a country without secure borders is less safe for those who look like me. And to make her point, she shocked many by quoting in full the offensive racial abuse she and her family and many others suffer. So when I sat down with her for an extended 40-minute conversation for my Political Thinking podcast, I asked her about her decision to use those words, which I should warn you, you're about to hear in full again. Why are we broadcasting them? Because she's made the escalating racial abuse some are facing central to her argument for those new policies.
I was responding to the Liberal Democrat spokesperson at the time, but I had a similar comment from others during the course of the debate in Parliament, which was to say that I was adopting far-right talking points, that there wasn't this problem in our country, that even acknowledging or suggesting there was somehow a failure on my part. And I just really wanted to lance that boil, because I think that that assertion comes from a place of privilege, which is a place where someone doesn't have to walk through their life in this country and ever hear themselves told to F off home. And I just really wanted to challenge that, because it is the direct opposite of why I am dealing with these issues. It's my job. I'm the Home Secretary. But I think that telling the truth about what the scale of a problem is the first step you have to take before you can think about what the correct solutions are. And it disappointed me very much that so many people in the House, they're still a minority, but, you know, they were pretty vocal, were wanting to suggest there wasn't a problem at all. It flies in the face of every experience that I have, my family has, and in fact that my constituents have as well.
That they are called what?
Fucking packies. I mean, it's. I half smiled when you said that you'd get in trouble for saying that word here on the BBC. I'm going to get in trouble from my mother, who does not like me swearing. And of everything she saw on Monday, my parents were very proud of me, but my mum said, please don't swear. So, but she knows that it's a swear word I am on the receiving end of. I mean, I don't pay attention to social media, actually, but there is a ton of abuse that comes in my direction, not just from anonymous accounts every day, but even worse, named people in the real world who email me and write to me and tell me. And if I didn't have police officers as part of my security detail these days, I'm sure many of those would come up to my face and say it too.
People would shout that abuse, effing P word, in your face.
Yes. And it has happened more in recent times to not just myself, but close family members. I worry about headscarf wearing women in my family in particular. I'm not alone in that. Every Muslim I know these days worries a lot more about vocal racism being shouted at them in the street.
You know what some say, and some said it in the House of Commons. They say you make it worse by saying that the country is divided. You're fueling the divide. You're legitimising the comments that some people make. But I'm struck by that phrase that you had. I know that a country without secure borders is a less safe country for those who look like me. You're claiming, are you, that if you get this right, this package on illegal immigration, there'll be less of that racist abuse?
I think that secure borders are a precondition to unlock what I also believe is true, which is that the British people are a generous people, that we have welcomed people from all over the world, and we have been willing to go on a journey with those people who have made this country their home, like my parents and others who've come here as migrants. We've gone on the journey with them, that at the end of that journey, they become one of us.
To spell out your fear if this doesn't work, or if these measures are not taken, you talked about fear turning into hatred. You talked in your conference speech about patriots like me, some of them, who've gone on to something much darker. Mm. What did you mean?
Look, I think what starts as resentment, a feeling of unfairness, can over time turn to anger, and anger over time for some people can turn to hate. And when I have been making my comments, so at conference, as you just quoted, or even in the chamber on Monday, I'm not addressing the people that have already crossed every line there is to cross. I'm not addressing the bigots and the people that don't think I'm English, the people that hate me because I'm a Muslim, that don't think I have a right to be in this country. They're not in my mind at all. What I'm addressing is the well of people who are angry and frustrated and who want change and who feel ignored. And I'm addressing them and I am saying to them, I recognise the thing that's fueling your resentment, that sense of unfairness, is a real thing. So firstly, I'm acknowledging they're not making it up. The bigots haven't got in their head and incepted them into believing a thing that is not true. They believe a thing that is true. I recognise the thing they believe is true. And what I'm saying to them is, I believe we in mainstream politics can speak to the challenge that you are making of us. We can run a better system. And that is why I think it's so important that we win this argument, because if we fail, if everyone in mainstream politics basically either doesn't want to talk about this, doesn't want to address it, or doesn't have the will to come up with the solutions that are needed, then I do think you leave the space for much darker
forces. But here's what worries some people. They say when you talk about bigots, they often think of Tommy Robinson, Stephen Yaxley Lennon, who tweeted not overt support for you, but he said the Overton window has been obliterated. Well done, patriots. In other words, he feels that your announcements are proof that he's winning because the window of acceptable ideas has been opened to these sorts of measures that would have been unthinkable for the Labour Party a few years ago.
No, I find it so offensive, actually, in the chamber when people were quoting that particular person at me. This is a person who hates me because I'm a Muslim, who thinks that I'm a lesser kind of human being because I'm a Muslim, and whose followers regularly tweet pictures of me at mosque events where I, of course, as a practicing Muslim woman, wear a headscarf, pictures of me with the word of God in Arabic behind me as a way of inciting hatred towards me. So it's deeply offensive. He knows what he's doing as well. He is setting his people once again after me. But I don't have any truck with anything that an individual like that has to say. But what I refuse to allow to happen is a legitimate discussion to be taken over by forces that are illegitimate. If mainstream politics cannot have a discussion about secure borders and the rules by which people enter this country and the rules by which they must leave, if we cede that territory to the far right, if we show that we are either unable, unwilling, or simply don't have the capacity to even think about the issue properly, and we cede it all to the far right, then we have let our country down.
You're shocking some people who are lifelong supporters of a British approach to refuge. Most notably, Lord Dubs, 92 now, came over to this country on the Kinder transport, the son of a Jewish father in Czechoslovakia who survived because of the welcome that Britain gave to him and 680-odd other children. He said to me on the Today programme the other morning, I am worried that Shabana Mahmood is using children as a weapon, because you've said that you would be willing to send children and families back home. What do you say to him?
Well, look, I adore Lord Alf Dubs. I think he's a really tremendous human being. And I always listen carefully to what he said. But on this occasion, I do disagree with him. Firstly, I would never use children as a weapon. That is not what is happening here. I set out a clear policy that for those people who arrive with their children, who are failed asylum seekers, we're not talking about people who have refugee status. We're talking about people who do not have refugee status because they've been through their multiple claims. They've been through the courts and they have been found not to be asylum seekers, not to be refugees. They've failed in their claim. We have not been removing those people to safe countries. I gave the example of Albania in my speech because we have a number of families from that country. This is a safe country. It's a signatory to the ECHR. We have a returns agreement with this country and we're not returning those families because they have at least one child who's under 18. I think a lot of
your listeners... Have you seen what the Albanian Prime Minister has said about this?
Yes, well...
He's accused you of ethnic stereotyping, indecent demagoguery, and he's accused of poorly echoing the rhetoric of the populist far right.
I obviously disagree. And look, we are talking about people who have failed in their asylum claim. We're not talking about people who are refugees.
At the moment, there are payments when people go home to encourage them to make that journey, to help them when they arrive in their home country. They're limited at £3,000, and you say you want them to go up. In Denmark, the country that you admire, they're over 20,000 bed. Are you willing to try that out?
Yes, so I've already asked my officials to pilot a small programme where we offer more than what we currently do for a period, just to see how that changes behaviour.
But a lot, 25,000, that sort of money.
Haven't alighted upon the full sums involved yet, but I am willing to consider a big increase on what we currently pay. And that is because for each asylum seeker in the country, it's £30,000 per individual per year. So it's a big sum of money. And if we can persuade people to return to their home country, with a cash payment, that is often better value for the taxpayer. I know it sticks in the craw of many people and they don't like it, but it is value for money. It does work. And a voluntary return is often the very best way to get people to return to their home country as quickly as possible.
A central philosophical thing that was the big change from the policies that Alf Dubs loved so much was the idea that asylum is temporary. Permanent. You're saying we may take some of your money away. We may bribe you to go back home. We may send you abroad with your children, even if they brought here. Wouldn't that be neatly summed up by the phrase hostile environment?
I think we're trying to show that there are ways to seek refuge and sanctuary in this country that we find acceptable because we can control them and we can do them in a way that unlocks the full...
It's hostile, though, isn't it? That was a phrase Theresa May used and was condemned by Labour people.
Look, I think we're a generous people, and I am deliberately trying to send a message, don't get on a boat. It is a dangerous thing to do. Mm-hmm. It puts your life at risk, but it also makes a lot of very bad people richer than they need to be.
That is part of a much longer conversation, 40 minutes in length, for my Political Thinking podcast. You can get it on BBC Sound. Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, talking to me there.
It's 23 minutes past eight. It's taking a lot longer than he thought. President Trump having said he could end the war, do you remember this, in Ukraine, in one day, is still trying to do so. Senior US military officials are in Ukraine today for talks on trying to do just that and are expected to meet President Zelensky. This is against a backdrop of unconfirmed reports that US and Russian officials have created a new peace plan with major concessions that have long been said to be red lines for Ukraine, something the former US ambassador to Ukraine refutes, William B. Taylor, saying appeasement is never a peace plan.
A lopsided agreement would not end the war. It would be a bad agreement. It would not end the war. They don't give peace prizes for appeasement, Emma, as you know. And that's what it would be. It would be an appeasement.
That was William talking to me earlier. In the last hour, the EU foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, said for any plan to work, it needs Ukrainians and Europeans on board. What can be agreed? What has been? Jeremy Bowen is our international editor. Jeremy, I mentioned those unconfirmed reports. What do we know?
Well, we know that the first noises coming out of the Ukrainians are not favourable on this. In this morning, the Ukrainian first deputy foreign minister has put on the social media X that it's, quote, a psychological manipulation effort rather than a credible proposal. Essentially, the reports, which started with the American news service Axios, effectively amount to a restatement of very long-standing Russian demands to take the whole of the Donbass, to effectively end Ukraine's existence as a sovereign nation. And I think the Ukrainians would be right to see this, as, and they have in the past when these proposals have been put forward in other forms, they see this as a capitulation to Russian demands. And I think that Putin would be able to present this quite credibly as a victory if it went ahead. And of course, for it to go ahead, it would first of all need Ukraine's consent. And also, Europeans would have to decide about pushing back against it, because the message from Keir Starmer, President Macron, France, and others consistently has been that Ukraine is the first line of defense for all of us against the Russians. And therefore, they'd have to drop all of that to accept this proposal.
What would it mean for Ukraine? It was interesting hearing from James Waterhouse earlier talking about Zelensky's domestic situation at the moment and some weakness on that front.
Yeah, I'd say weakness is an understatement. At the moment, President Zelensky of Ukraine is really undergoing possibly the worst crisis he's faced since the invasion, which was almost 4 years ago. And this is a massive corruption scandal. It may well be that President Trump, with his capacity for smelling blood in the water, sees this as a moment of weakness and therefore a moment of leverage. Essentially, what's come out is from the Ukraine's own anti-corruption agencies, and Ukraine has a long history of corruption going back a long time, is that something like $100 billion has been creamed off from contracts with Ukraine's nuclear power program. And some of these projects were supposed to protect electricity plants from Russian attacks. So you can imagine the anger inside Ukraine about it. You know, there have been bags of cash allegedly uncovered in the ringleader's apartment, where he had a golden lavatory and a bidet, being photos of that. He's fled the country. Now, Zelensky is under huge pressure to restructure his government, perhaps get rid of his very powerful chief of staff and major ally, Andriy Yermak, because of all of this. No one's at the moment saying that Zelensky is implicated in it. But, you know, in any state, corruption is like a cancer. And I remember early on in the war, I was talking to a British lawyer who was trying to sue people to get back money on behalf of the Ukrainian government, to try and get back money that had been stolen. I asked him give me marks out of 10 for the level of corruption in Ukraine just before the war. And he said it's about 12 out of 10. And they have been working on this. And it's a good sign that their own anti-corruption agencies have uncovered all of this. But at the same time, it means that the earth is shifting underneath Zelensky at the moment. And that makes it very, very difficult for him.
And as you say, that might be an opening, as it were, for Donald Trump in this moment. We shall see. There are a lot of unconfirmed reports. We'll keep you up to date as they get confirmed or not. Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, thank you.
It's now 28 minutes past 8. Here's Mike with the sport.
Nick, thank you. Cricket fans are getting very excited because it's almost time.
The history of England v Australia obviously goes back for 140 years.
Australians are great fighters and never beaten till the last ball is bowled.
Here's Willis. He bowls to Bright. Bright bowled! The middle stamps out of the ground. England have won. Willis runs around, punching the air.
There's always so many words said before the series.
Shane Warne bowls and Gatting is taken on the pace. Bowled!
We know that there's been some incredible achievements before us.
Kasparovic goes back and parries one as he caught down the leg side. He's out!
It's exciting that it's starting tomorrow.
And the first ball, he's bowled him! He's bowled him first ball!
This is our time to put our own mark in Ashes team, and in particular England teams coming to Australia.
Hopefully we can put on a really good show and entertain plenty of people.
He bowls to Stokes, who hammers it for four!
Yes, after what feels like months of build-up, the 2025 Men's Ashes finally gets underway in the early hours of tomorrow morning. The first test between Australia and England starts in Perth at 2:20 a.m. UK time. So let's get a definitive look ahead to this match and the series as a whole with the former England captain David Gower and the Australian cricket journalist and broadcaster Jeff Lemon, who both join us now live from Perth. Morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Okay, correct. Yeah, I stand corrected, of course. It is afternoon yes. With you out in Western Australia. Let's start, though, with you, Jeff. I believe you are at the stadium in Perth. Set the scene for us.
Yes, at the new stadium, the one across the river. So they're not playing at the Wacker anymore these days for these test matches. But it's a huge ground, and we've never seen it filled for a test match before. We had 30-odd thousand in last year for India, but it can take about 60,000, and apparently those seats are sold out. So hopefully everybody rocks up for day one and actually shows us what this ground can do when it's full for a test match.
David, England appear quietly confident. Do you agree with many observers that this is their best chance of winning an Ashes in Australia since they last did it in 2010-11?
Yeah, I do. I think they have a very good chance. A lot can happen, we know that. The art of prediction is what's known as a complete waste of time. But they have strength in batting. They've got this fast bowling attack. They've got the perfect chance here in Perth if they just get it right, because, of course, a couple of key players missing for Australia, a bit of uncertainty about their batting.
And you've got to prey on any little weakness you can find in this country and try and get that early advantage. So actually, these next 5 days are very, very key and very, very interesting.
Might one of those weaknesses, Jeff, that David mentions, be the absence for Australia of the captain, Pat Cummings, and fellow fast bowler Josh Hazlewood?
Well, it's enormous, enormous to be missing two players of that calibre. You know, Pat Cummins just went past 300 test wickets recently. Josh Hazlewood is only 5 wickets away from that mark itself. And it's such an important mark for Australian fast bowlers. Only the best of the best have passed 300 wickets. Mitchell Johnson, Brett Lee, Dennis Lilly, Glenn McGrath, and Mitchell Stark, the others. So Stark is here and playing, but losing his two right armers, you know, he's a left armer. He attacks, he pitches the ball up and swings it, drops it short now and again. And he relies so much on Hazlewood and Cummins to strangle at the other end, to be metronomic, to give so little away and allow him to attack. So instead of that, he's going to have a much more inexperienced couple of bowlers who'll be backing him up. He's got Brendan Doggett on debut. He's got Scott Boland, who certainly had his moments in Ashes test matches, but he's only played 14 tests in a career despite being a very experienced player. So it's an enormous, enormous loss to have Hazlewood and Cummins missing at the same time.
And David, just talk to us about England's pace attack, because it's an embarrassment of riches almost, isn't it? You've got the likes of Gus Atkinson, Jofra Archer, Brydon Carse, Mark Wood, all capable of bowling over 90 miles an hour.
Yes. The key thing, again, any English bowler will tell you, even to the likes of, say, the great Bob Willis, my great mate and former colleague, you have to hit the right lengths. Even with that pace, you've got to hit the right lengths to be effective. And Perth pitches, the old one and this new one, have a sort of bounce that sometimes takes time to locate that right length. But having that pace is invaluable. Having Archer absolutely fit is a key thing. Woody, of course, Mark Wood, if he can contribute, he won't play five, that's for sure. But if he can contribute, that makes a big difference. And you've got the key man you haven't mentioned is Stokes. In every sense, Stokes as a leader, Stokes as an all-rounder. You know, Stokes as a man who changes things around with the ball when he's fully fit. And he's promised us all that he is fit and strong and won't break down and knows how to work his, manage his workload. And for him, of course, this is such a big tour. Whatever he says to dismiss ambition, his greatest ambition must surely be to be an Ashes winning captain. And so he has to lead from the front. I think he is England's key man.
Prediction time for both of you. Jeff, how do you see this first test and the series going?
Well, I'm not predicting things from a parochial standpoint, but just because I've been burned too many times before with England teams coming here with big expectations and not being competitive, I would actually like to see a competitive series. It's more interesting than a 4-0 or a 5-0. So I'm reluctant to back England just because they've let me down so often in my lifetime. So I'm going 3-1 Australia, but I'm not entirely convinced by this Australian team either.
David, I know you just said prediction is a foolish pursuit, but come on, nail your colours to the mast.
Look, hang on, money on the table, please. You don't get this for free. I have just been to a lunch. We were all asked the same question there. I've said 3-2 to England, so there you are.
Right, we shall see.
It'll be a good one if it's 3-2.
It certainly will.
Absolutely, yeah.
And we cannot wait. The first tester, what are we now? 18 hours to go until it all gets underway, 2:20 a.m. our time. David Gower and Jeff Lemon, they're live in Perth. Many thanks for joining us this morning. And, of course, we should say that you cannot move for Ashes coverage on the BBC. It will take me the rest of the programme to list out all the different coverage. But the most important is, of course, Test Match Special on BBC Sounds and Five Sports Extra from, I think, 1:30 a.m. So set your alarms or stay up all night. Pull an all night. That's what I'll be doing.
We don't need to set alarms. Just awake. Yes. There's so much hurt baked into those predictions, weren't there? Yeah. So much betrayal.
I've actually booked tomorrow off to listen and follow the Ashes.
Good man.
So Jonathan Ledyard will be here tomorrow bulletin at 6:25, hopefully with good news from Perth.
You enjoy. Right, well, let's look, talking about times, to tomorrow evening.
Playlist is back with a new series.
Each episode, we compile a playlist of 5 songs, tracks, or pieces of music that we discuss and unpick in loving detail, one after the other.
This is what I like about Teardrop, is that actually it's very, very, very simple.
But the game we play is that each track has to be linked to the one that came before it via a nugget of information that might be musical, contextual, historical, technical, and more.
Handel is a brilliant painter of pictures.
The new series of Add to Playlist.
I put it on my headphones as I was walking down the street and I felt invincible.
On Friday nights at 7:15.
You haven't heard it like this.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
If you haven't tried that series, do. It really is excellent. Quick look at the weather now. Clear and dry in the west, mostly cloudy in the east, with scattered snow showers. Rainy later, and the one-word summary, really. Cold.
He's right. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Emma Barnett. Thank you for being with us. It's 24 minutes to nine. Let's get a summary of the news with Jane Steele.
American military officials are in Ukraine for talks on possible ways of ending the war, with some reports suggesting that Washington and Moscow have held discussions without Kiev and are proposing that it make major territorial concessions. The EU's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, says for any peace plan to work, it needs to have Ukrainians and Europeans on board. This morning, President Zelensky said 22 people were still missing after yesterday's Russian strike on Ternopil in western Ukraine, which killed 26 people. President Trump says he has signed a bill approving the release by the US Justice Department of documents from its criminal investigation into the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The Justice Department now has 30 days to release the files. The COVID inquiry will this afternoon publish its findings on the government's response to the pandemic. It also assessed the implementation of lockdowns. The Office for Students predicts that almost half of universities in England will be in deficit by next summer, despite the loss of thousands of jobs across higher education. The Department for Education says it has taken action to put the sector on a secure footing.
Jane, thank you. 23 minutes to nine. Let's think about Australia, if you're a teenager, what that would be like, because you're waking up to the news from the social media giant Meta that your account will be shut down. Meta, of course, owning Instagram, Facebook, also an owner of the owner of WhatsApp. But ahead of the country's social media ban for under 16s coming into force on December the 10th, how are teenagers feeling about it? Well, they can still, just for a few more weeks, share on social media how they're feeling about it, certainly legally. Richard Graham, who teaches at Woodcroft College in the south of Adelaide, recorded for us a conversation about the new laws with 13 and 14-year-olds.
OK, so we're here with Maya, Layla, Ivy, Ted and Logan. What do you think of the idea of the social media ban for under-16s here in Australia?
I think it's pointless. I think there's so many better things that they could do to keep children safe, and I think no matter what, how hard they try, people are always going to find a way around it, and it's just a big waste of money, big waste of time. There's better things that they can be doing.
And because they've just, like, banned it, everyone's going to, like, find ways around it.
With, like, America with the TikTok ban, it just came online the next morning.
Yeah. And I think something that they haven't thought about is social media is, like, a main resource of communication between people, like, especially young people.
And also teens, they basically, like, Snap. It's basically, like, where everyone talks and, like, how teens communicate.
And I also think that not all social media is negative. Like, there has been some negative effects, but also you can still learn things from social media. Like, it's not all bad.
Instead of the ban, they could make under 16, like, have private accounts with just friends or, like...
Or, like, they must be parent-managed or something.
Yeah, add limits, not bans, because, like, that could mean limiting the comments or even the algorithms that you can see, just changing the way that you see your social media.
So do you all think that you and your friends will find ways around the law?
Definitely.
I think some people definitely will,
So many, like, I know someone who's asked her older brother to get her a burner phone that she can set up with her 18-year-old brother's Face ID so that she can have those social medias because people are just that addicted.
When I first got my TikTok account, which is a private account, it was my mum's account, so it's under my mum's, like, information, and I think they could just easily put in their parents', like, ID.
That was Maya, Layla, Ivy, Ted and Logan. Not mincing their words. Joining us now, Greg Adwells, the director of the 36 Months campaign, which called for the social media age requirements in Australia to be raised to 16 from 13, hence the 36 months for the name. The campaign garnered over 100,000 signatures and, crucially, the support of the Prime Minister, who passed the world-leading law, as it's been described, aimed at, in his words, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, letting kids be kids. Greg Adwells is the director, as I say, of this campaign. Greg, You heard there, it's pointless. We're going to find a way around it. We don't want this, and social media can be good, and it's how we talk to each other. What do you say to all of that?
Yeah, look, 147,000 parents signed a petition in Australia asking for one thing, 36 months, not a ban, a buffer, which is more time for kids to get to know themselves before the world does. And parents are up against trillion-dollar attention engines in big tech, and it's very difficult to out-parent an algorithm that's been weaponized to exploit vulnerability. We're not trying to lock kids out of the internet. We're not trying to stop them communicating with each other online. This is simply about pausing account creation. So delaying by 36 months the moment that they become a digital citizen of a social media ecosystem.
And I recognise that's your campaign, but we've also got the reality of what's going to happen in just a matter of days to teenagers in Australia when it comes to social media. And do you think it will work? How do you see this playing out? It is, you know, as some have described it, a world-leading piece of legislation.
Yeah, definitely. And look, I am proud of our government for leading the way on this. You know, when it comes to money, societal power, lobbying reach, nothing comes close to big tech. And when a government chooses to side with families instead of playing into their hand, that's leadership, and I think we should back it. That said, if I was big tech at the moment, I would want to confuse and confound as much as possible. I spoke with someone from one of the big tech platforms just a few months ago, and I asked them, what are you worried about? Like, just be real with me. And they said, look, to be honest with you, this is a global contagion risk for us. That was the exact phrase that they used. They are worried about what is happening in Australia, spreading around to other jurisdictions around the world. And they're using language like a pandemic or a virus. So they are wanting to contain this to this part of the world because they're scared about what it's going to do to their revenue and their user base and all of those things. If I was working for big tech at the moment, I would want to make the rollout of this as wobbly, as complex, as confusing, and as imperfect as possible to deter other countries from following suit.
And meanwhile, you've got a lot of young people who are going to try and thwart it as well.
Yeah, look, kids are smart.
You can remember yourself being one of those. I'm thinking back to my own teenagers and being a teenager rather. And, you know, if the landline had been taken, I would have gone and bought my own, you know, handset and plugged it in somehow. I don't know. Yeah, you know, I don't know what the workarounds were, but the equivalents, you'll find a workaround as a teenager, won't you?
Yeah, look, okay, there's maybe two sides to this, right? Yes. Kids find a way around things. Like even though alcohol, you can't drink under the age of 18 here in Australia, but if you go down to the park on a Saturday night, you're going to find kids underage drinking alcohol, right? But it doesn't mean that the law shouldn't exist. It just means that, you know, kids can sometimes have a tendency to find their way around things, but we don't. We still have regulations that exist for their safety, right? And I don't love the word ban because we're not banning alcohol for under 18s. We're not banning driving for kids under 16. We're just saying, look, in order to safely engage with these activities, there needs to be a level of developmental maturity. And that's what Australia has done. It's looked at social media.
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry, Greg, but we will see how this goes as it's beginning. And there's been notifications this morning that those under 16 have been receiving that they'll be blocked from slightly earlier than they thought from December the 4th. So just in time for Christmas. Greg, thank you very much.
It is 9:15 now, and it is 80 years since the Nuremberg trials. The trials of the most prominent Nazi leaders for their crimes during the Second World War. When the chief American prosecutor, Justice Jackson, opened the Allied case against the defendants, he reflected on the historical significance of that moment.
Opening the first trial in history for crimes against the peace of the world imposes a grave responsibility. The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant and so devastating, that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored because it cannot survive their being repeated.
One of those who's consistently reflected on the importance of international law is Philippe Sands, Professor of Law at University College London, whose book East West Street on the Origins of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity connected the story of his family with the story of international law. Philippe, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Reflect for us what your thoughts are as you hear 80 years on that piece of archive. What did that trial do for our understanding of the role of international law?
Always an amazing moment to listen to Robert Jackson. It leaves a really strong feeling. Basically, all roads in the modern system that we have today lead back to Nuremberg. But for Nuremberg, we wouldn't have had the tribunals in Rwanda and Yugoslavia and the International Criminal Court and the more recent indictments. We wouldn't have, I think, had all the treaties on genocide and torture and so on and so forth. But of course, we look around the world today and we see in many parts of the world, whether it's Ukraine or Sudan or Israel or Palestine or other places, that it didn't stop the emergence of these principles, these rules, these institutions. Has given us a roadmap for what's permissible and what's not permissible, but the horrors continue, and I think that is a pause for reflection.
Was that the hope? Was that the belief, indeed, of the people involved in those trials, that this would send a signal to people, we will get you, justice will catch up with you, so don't commit these crimes?
Well, I think in a sense it was, and it has to a certain extent had that effect. And we've got plenty of anecdotal evidence of people sort of curtailing their travels because they worry about a tap on the shoulder. But I think people were sanguine. They understood that just with domestic laws on rape and murder and other horrors, the mere fact of passing laws is not going to change human behaviour. I think what's interesting for me right now is that at the last major anniversary, the 75th, I could still get on the phone and call someone and say, what was it like to be in the room when Jackson spoke? Yves Begbeder, for example, who's the assistant to the French judge. But now with the 80th, the last people have gone. And so we're in a different space. It's no longer possible to speak to anyone who was present in the room. And I think that has implications also.
Do you fear that what has died with them is the belief in rules, a belief in a world with rules, rules that apply to everybody, whether in democracies or indeed in dictatorships?
No, I don't, actually. I mean, I think these things go in cycles. I think we're plainly facing a very difficult moment right now, whether it's the sort of occupation of Ukraine or various other things that are taking place. Plainly, the rules are being violated. But they haven't disappeared. We're not in a post-rules world. These things go in cycles. We're in a down moment, and we will recover. That's what history has shown over the last 2-3 years.
And yet you'll know there are people like Professor John Bew, history professor at King's College London, who've said we're in an era of the assertion of raw power. And he's thinking of Trump, of course, isn't he? Not just what we would expect from dictatorships.
He is, and I have a lot of time for him. He wrote a wonderful biography of Clement Attlee, who was a strong believer in a multilateral systems. But John, I fear, is just wrong. If you take a long view of history, you see that these things go in cycles. And frankly, most international rules operate very well. I gave the 46th Francis Mann lecture a couple of days ago, and I addressed this issue. Most international rules work perfectly well. You and I speaking right now is possible in the way that it is because of a whole raft of international conventions that allow these things to happen. And we forget the sort of silent success of much of international law, but we can't run away from the fact that in certain parts of the world, in relation to certain laws right now, things are not working as they should.
Philippe Sands, Professor of Law at University College London, thanks for joining us.
It's 11 minutes to 9.
Let us turn now to news about cancer and cancer diagnosis. NHS doctors say they plan to use AI to spot growths that could lead to bowel cancer. The National Institute for Health and Care Excellent, NICE, has said 5 technologies should be made available whilst more evidence is gathered on whether they save lives. Let's join the National Clinical Director for Cancer at NHS England, Professor Peter Johnson. Good morning to you, Peter.
Good morning, Nick.
This is being described as a second pair of eyes, this technology. How will it work?
Yes, so the AI technology helps people who are carrying out a colonoscopy, examining the inside of the bowel for polyps, which can lead on to cancer sometimes, but don't always by any means. And it helps the person doing the procedure to spot small polyps. And also it can help to characterize them, because some of them look nasty and some of them will be benign. And the AI can often tell the difference between those two. So what we want to see is whether rolling this out at scale in the NHS will help us to prevent more cancers and diagnose more cancers quickly. We need to get the evidence, because as always with these new technologies, you want to be sure that it does what it purports to do. But these five new technologies that we're going to be able to trial, and many of them are in use already, look very promising for this.
Is this making up for human error? In other words, for things that a doctor may miss, or are the things the technology can see, which the human eye, even assisted by technology, cannot see?
No test is perfect, and certainly any test that depends on human observation will always have the occasional polyp and so forth that it overlooks. So this is a way of helping people to be more accurate in the work they do. So it's mostly about picking up things that might otherwise have gone undetected. The great thing about bowel cancer screening is not only does it help us to diagnose cancers early, but it actually helps to prevent them, because if you remove polyps before they can turn cancerous, you actually reduce the number of people who actually go on to get bowel cancer in due course.
Is it possible we move to a world quite quickly in which no doctors involved at all, that this is done purely by technology? And the truth is, when it comes to a standard cancer scan, the technology beats a doctor every day of the week, doesn't it?
Probably not, actually. The technology we're using, and we're using it not just for things like colonoscopy, but for diagnosing skin cancers and prostate cancers and breast cancers and lung cancers, is about helping us to be more efficient with the people that we've got. We know that we have huge pressure on the NHS from the numbers of people that need investigation. And the AI really is about helping us to work more efficiently and making sure that we can see more people quickly and that we can diagnose them more rapidly. So this is absolutely not about replacing doctors and nurses.
Just to be clear, Professor Johnson, as to why that is, I'm sorry to interrupt, but are you saying don't replace the doctors because, frankly, patients would loathe the idea of no doctor being involved? Or is there actually a scientific reason? Is there evidence that you need to have humans involved?
At the moment, the AI looks as though it's very good at helping people to be more productive, but it isn't something, for the most part, that's going to replace doctors. The first AI program that we're rolling out, where we're seeing if it'll work on its own, is looking for skin cancers. And so this is dermoscopy pictures which are transmitted and can be diagnosed automatically by the AI system. We're doing this very carefully, and we're carefully evaluating it to make sure that it performs as well as a dermatologist in categorizing skin lesions. So we have to be really cautious about this. We know that AI generally makes fewer mistakes than human beings, but we need to be quite sure that it really does what it says it will do.
Professor Peter Johnson there, National Clinical Director for Cancer at NHS England. Thank you for joining us.
7 minutes to 9. Let me tell you about this, because with Melvyn Bragg stepping down from presenting In Our Time, Radio 4 has been asking several well-known fans of the programme to pick out some favourite episodes from the archives. And today, the elbow singer Guy Garvey selects an edition about eclipses. That's right. Good one, Guy. I actually really want to hear that. We've been doing a lot on supermoons as well lately, haven't we? But you can hear Melvyn and guests discuss the scientific advances gained from studying eclipses in our time this morning at 9. But at 6 minutes to 9, we've just got time to tell you about rules, maths and music, because the long history of rules and instructions and maths to try and make music is going to be explored this evening at the London Contemporary Music Festival. In an era concerned about computers scraping data for artificial music, and where listeners can struggle to tell the difference between AI-generated and human-composed songs, we were talking about it with books earlier, does a rich history of using maths to make music and to create it show the way forward for AI and how it might be deployed, not just in the future, but now? Let's listen to Mozart, a part of Mozart's musical dice game. Mm-hmm. Listening with us is Igor Toroni-Lalic, the artistic co-director of the London Contemporary Music Festival, which this evening will be performing at the, or having a performance, I should say, at the Wigmore Hall in London, and Professor Jennifer Walsh, contemporary classical composer and professor of composition at Oxford University. Jennifer, if I could just come to you first. We were listening, I said, Mozart's Dice Game. Was this a system? Tell us more.
Well, I sort of think when I listen to the Dice Game, am I listening to a piece of music? Am I listening to a mathematical diversion? Or am I listening to a commercial product aimed at a demographic who wanted their own little bespoke Mozart waltzes that they could whip up in a salon? So that's sort of how I come to it. It's not simply a piece of music. It's a lot of different things.
Because there was a system for using dice to randomly generate music from pre-composed options. Is that right?
It consists of grids of numbers, and you toss dice, and then you refer to a certain bar number, and you write that bar down. So, you know, anybody could sort of roll the dice, and because you're writing in 3/4, and you have this little waltz, and you can sort of use the structures of harmony to sort of figure out where there's a cadence or where there's not a cadence, or at least Mozart could, or if he indeed wrote it, or if he did indeed complete it, he could. Anybody could interact with the system and make a piece of music.
Igor, morning to you. Welcome. The history of this and the beginning of notation, tell us a bit more about that and what you're going to share this evening. What examples?
Well, I mean, the argument is that algorithmic composition has been there from the beginning of music. I mean, it's a millennia old, actually. Before 1066, people were suggesting ways in which to make music according to algorithmic instructions. And Mozart is an example of this. The Mozart Dice Game is an example of this. You know, it's essentially algorithmic. You're automatically generating a composition. And then it really kind of blossoms in the 20th century, where composers realize that there's something incredibly liberating about using these procedures, these systems, these algorithmic instructions to take you away from, you know, the most important thing in the creative act is to try to not be cliché, to avoid your own ego, the clichés of your own ego and the clichés of society. And how do you do that? You potentially do that by applying procedures and systems that take you out of yourself, that, you know, where you can actually kind of compose in a way that's much more kind of random and spontaneous. I mean,
How is it, sorry, forgive my ignorance, how is it random and spontaneous if you're using an algorithm? This sounds almost the opposite, that it could be prescribed in some way.
It does sound like the opposite, doesn't it? It's the paradox. You know, there is, for example, we're doing some pieces for player piano. So a piano that plays itself. And, you know, within this piece, the spontaneity, the explosive sort of quality of this piece could only be done within a mechanized, sort of within a highly controlled, ordered system. Because a sort of human will only be able to be spontaneous to a certain degree. But if you have, you know, punched holes according to very complex kind of irrational numbers, that, you know, just like an actual explosion, you need to be highly controlled to make things truly explode. You know, it's a very strange paradox.
It is. Thank you for trying to take us into that, especially, you know, without more music to illustrate it as well, and I suppose seeing it. Jennifer, how does this point perhaps to where we are with AI now?
Well, I think it's really helpful to see it as a continuum rather than a sort of a paradigm shift in the word that, if I'm, you know, paraphrasing people from Silicon Valley, in that this sort of manner of algorithmic thinking and even sort of how that can be positioned in terms of the market, that's existed for a very long time. Right now, you know, the top of the charts for the Billboard country and Western charts in America is an AI generated track. Nobody's quite sure who is the person who generated the music, but